All right. So that makes it 7:10 by my clock. All right. Welcome, everybody, to the second anniversary of the heroic Al-Aqsa Flood Resistance Operation. Glory to the martyrs, and of course, death to Israel. We've got a great show for you all today. It looks to me that we've got just about 263 people listening to the space, including 206 haters and losers listening anonymously. We've put together a great panel of alleged has-beens and literal who's, including, eventually, Dr. Kevin MacDonald, author of the Culture of Critique trilogy and Individualism in the Western Liberal Tradition. We have rightful Dr. Germar Rudolph, the foremost expert on the Holocaust. I say rightful because, despite Dr. Rudolph completing his coursework and publishing dozens of books, the Jew-American occupation government in Germany has made it illegal to provide Dr. Rudolph with the credential he has earned multiple times over. Myself, Dr. Marcel Dumas, Austrian economist, host of the Property and Freedom Book Club, and writer of Bias Confirmations. Michael Mike Enoch Painovich, sorry, give me a second to slow down, host of The Daily Shoah, Mike Check, and Painovich and Boscovich on the rightstuff.biz. Josh Neal, author of American Extremist, Understanding Conspiracy Theories, and Intolerant Interpretations. Eventually, Lewis London, co-founder of Antelope Hill Publishing, co-host of the Eviction Notice podcast, and TRS military correspondent. Seth Dumernat Carrero, Eviction Notice co-host and contributor to TRS. Borzoi Boscovich, co-host of Painovich and Boscovich, The Third Rail, and a few other shows on TRS. And Jose Nino, host of the Barnes Review Radio and writer for the Occidental Observer. 2 years ago, after 100 years of dehumanization, 80 years of expulsion, 60 years of occupation, 40 years of fake peace, 20 years of blockade, and the appointment of genocidal inbred mutant freak Itamar Ben-Gvir as National Security Minister, resulting in 2023 being the deadliest year for Palestinian children on record before the month of October, forces of the Izzedine Al-Qassam Brigades commenced a surprise offensive against Zionist occupation. Hundreds of Nukba commandos paraglided out of the sky, supplemented by thousands of Qassam brigadiers breaching the fence. Resistance fighters engaged occupation forces in military bases and illegal Jew settlements around the Gaza Strip and captured hundreds of prisoners, both active duty Israeli militants and IDF reservists, many who were holding a drug-fueled rave within sight of the concentration camp. Jewish forces were humiliated. Photos show triumphant resistance fighters tearing Jewish soldiers from famed Israeli Merkava tanks. Hundreds of Palestinians woke up to find themselves free to leave their open-air prison and walk lands from whom they, their parents, and their grandparents had been marched at gunpoint by Jewish terrorists in 1948. The myth of Israeli invincibility was shattered as reinforcements from the Israeli defense forces were seemingly nowhere to be seen. Nowhere, that is, except for listening posts around the Strip in the form of tens of thousands of reservists in the militarized settlements surrounding it, waiting for the call that would instantly mobilize them, and, of course, carrying out its so-called Hannibal Directive, by which ground and air forces aim to destroy any vehicle or structure between themselves and Gaza to ensure that no one, Jewish prisoner or Palestinian fighter, returned to Gaza alive. Jews responded predictably and genocidally, placing the already besieged and blockaded Strip under what Defense Minister Yoav Gallant called a complete siege. There will be no electricity, no food, no fuel. Everything is closed. We are fighting human animals and we act accordingly. The Jews proceeded to systematically bomb every single school, hospital, and bakery in the Gaza Strip, carrying out the world's first aerial genocide. Armed by the Jew-American Empire, Jews have destroyed 70% of structures in Gaza and murdered 630,000 people in the world's most deranged game of red light, green light, both on the scale of moving and shrinking safe zones and food aid facilities turned into killing fields located in so-called combat zones. The Jews have also brought ISIS to the Gaza Strip in the form of Yasser Abu Sabab's popular forces. Jewish military spokespeople, Jewish news media, and Jewish citizens of every Western nation began circulating defamatory propaganda against the resistance. Heroic Islamic warriors were accused of beheading babies, putting babies into ovens and microwaves, raping Jewish women, and playing hacky sack with women's breasts. Jews around the world mobilized into action, converting every civilian resource at their disposal, whether finance, media, or academia, into material for the Zionist military apparatus. Comedians, college professors, and hedge fund managers were shocked and hurt to discover that their friends and coworkers maintain a steadfast objection to murdering children, even when Jews complained that such moral objections made them feel uncomfortable. They responded with a betrayal of their own. The progressive stack revealed its horrifying simplicity, as women, children, cripples, geriatrics, blacks, and even homosexuals in every variety found their access to institutions made conditional on submission to Jewish congressional tribunals. Black women were driven from their academic positions on plagiarism accusations. MSNBC, the most progressive news outlet on television, purged every single Arab, Muslim, or otherwise suspicious West Asian from their lineup, including Mehdi Hassan. If the betrayal on the left was comical, the betrayal on the right was enraging. The most taboo beliefs were suddenly on the table in a so-called vibe shift aimed at restoring New York real estate investor Zion Donald Trump to the presidency. Dark enlightenment, the intellectual dark web, barbarian vitalism, even human biodiversity were weaponized to explain how it was rational, liberal, based, Nietzschean, Christian, and even Volkish to run interference for Jewish criminals on the grounds that Palestinians were inbred, low IQ, longhouse, collectivist, chimping out, and brown. Newly radicalized whites, eyes freshly opened to the reality that the American welfare warfare state wants them broke, dead, their kids raped and brainwashed, assuming they could even start a family, and thinks it's funny, were promptly de-radicalized and off-ramped into custom-made Jewish intellectual movements, preying on their fears of loneliness with their blue-pilled IRL circles. Take the W, they were told. Supporting Palestine is left-coded, brown-coded, third-world-coded, gin-brained, peasant-coded, low-IQ, and even possibly trans. This was the deal the intellectual thought leaders on the right, on the alt-Zog kosher right, claimed to be making. The based Jew, Stephen Miller, was going to save America from the white minority being engineered by the Jew-run SPLC. What were the terms of this deal? Who was it being made with? Where was this negotiating table? Why would Jews agree to it? How would rightoids enforce it? Hey, shut up. The Jews were going to realize what a big mistake they made, replacing white people with unruly brownoids, and they needed to be reassured what good goys the white man was born to be. When Visegrad 24 voiced the shape of this deal aloud to the Jewish Jonathan Greenblatt, CEO of the B'nai B'rith Anti-Defamation League, Greenblatt was hurt and offended at the idea that the world's largest NGO would ever take a moment's rest from its 100-year mission of dismantling every white advocacy organization in America and the world. The transition from revolutionary populism to aspiring golems was a big change for the right to make, and Jews played a leading role in that transformation. Today, we brought the top experts on the world's oldest question together to help you understand the answer to the question that Hillary Clinton asked on the 9th of November, 2016. What happened? And more importantly, how do we make sure this doesn't happen again? Thank you.
Well said. Well said. Very well said. So I guess let's get started. I mean, this is ultimately, this is a celebration at the end of the day, right? This is the 2-year anniversary celebrating the time where people actually fought back. Someone, you know, people said that they had had enough. And they decided to take action, righteous fury, manifested in decisive political action. There's been a lot of destruction in Gaza since. Thousands, hundreds of thousands have died. Around 70% of the city, the strip, has been destroyed, as Marcel said. And ever since then, we have been hit with nothing but Hasbara from the right wing and the left wing. And ultimately, it has been unsuccessful. The majority of almost all European Western countries, majorities of these countries, these populations, disapprove of Israel, and they disapprove of their actions. But the policies of these Western governments have not changed. In one of the most undemocratic policies that we've ever seen, Western governments have decided to back a full-scale genocide against the wishes of its population, and basically the most evil atrocities that we've ever seen. So, yes, yeah. Does anybody have any comments? Anybody have anything to say?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say that. Go ahead, Grimar. I'll wait.
Okay. You. Thank you. I'm in the field of researching, publishing about the quote-unquote best documented genocide.
You muted yourself, Grimar. Dr. Rudolph, you muted your microphone by mistake.
Sorry. So I must have clicked it twice. I'm in the field of researching what the mainstream calls the best documented genocide in the history of mankind. That's the Holocaust. And I must say, after what has happened since October 7th, two years ago, the Holocaust had to make room and move down in the ranks one position, because the best documented genocide is definitely now the Gaza genocide, with cameras rolling, with cell phones capturing everything, every aspect of it, which is something which we absolutely do not have in any way, shape, or form about the quote-unquote Holocaust. There's no footage about anything. Oh, well, I'd say hardly any that is brought in that context, and that is very often misrepresented. So the Jewish state, the Zionist state, has now, for everyone to see, blood on their hand for a genocide. The ones who have claimed for decades to be the primary victim of the worst genocide in the history of mankind are now the perpetrators. So I can give a shout out to them and say, welcome to the club.
Well, the problem is, though, like, we were never really members of the club. It's a blood libel and a slander. And as I've said often, the very concept of genocide is a Jewish concept. They came up with the idea. It's their idea. They first talked about themselves doing it with pride in their ancient writings. And now they're carrying those out, which are, by the way, most likely not true. Like, there's no archaeological evidence any of that is true. But there's plenty of evidence that it's true today. It's very ironic. Mark Levin, actually, Chris Menahan has a video right now up on his Twitter account of Mark Levin saying exactly the opposite of the truth, which is that they have so much film of the Holocaust and evidence of it, and there's like no evidence of this genocide in Gaza. One thing I've seen a lot of people say is, well, wasn't it stupid for the Palestinians to do this? Wasn't this a dumb move? Haven't they walked into something? Haven't they invited this destruction upon their people? And I would say, well, one, it's not my decision to say that, right? It's not up to me to decide that for them. They decided it was time to act. And frankly, it's not as if they were not already marked for death. The United States, Donald Trump's first government, and then the Biden government as well. Generally, the United States is of one mind. It does not change based on voting for parties, the support of the Jewish state. And the diplomatic support given to the Arab states and the Abraham Accords and things like this, they were on the brink of permanently politically isolating the Palestinians, and as the Jews had put it, finally ending the Arab-Israeli conflict, which just means ultimately death for Palestine. So this was a final desperation move, and it set the clock back on Zionist normalization, Israeli normalization, Israeli integration into the region, which is something that they are now trying to get. They're trying to buy it on the cheap with the kind of diplomatic negotiating they're doing now. And yes, many people, most likely hundreds of thousands, we don't know. The official count is 67,000. I'm sure that's an undercount. But that on top of that, you have the number of children that have lost limbs. You have the number of people that have gone through just unimaginable trauma. These Jews talk about trauma and the Holocaust and the generational trauma. Nobody knows trauma like people that live in the Gaza Strip. I don't think anybody can understand the fear of any day, any hour, any minute, a Jewish bomb could come and blow up your tent, your refugee camp, wherever you're hiding, wherever you're staying now that is, you were told it was safe 1 hour. The Jews have said, no, this is not a safe zone anymore. Now you have to clear out. It is when you really look, and you know, I got into Palestine activism very early in my political life. It's one of the first things I got interested in. And it's because what was detailed to me was some of the arbitrary, capricious, and cruel things that are done to them, seemingly just because the Jews think it's funny, but mainly because they want to make it impossible. They want to make the idea of living there impossible. They want to make it so, okay, you want to live here. Your life is going to be a series of hoops that you're going to have to jump through, a series of constant humiliations. You know, and it's exactly, it's amazing when you hear the Jews try and get pity for their supposed experiences in Europe they are acting out everything that they have lied about. Every blood libel against Europeans is being acted out now. They are the ones doing it because these are in their brains. These things are in their minds. These are the things that they do. And so now we see. And that's why, no, I don't care about the optics of this or the politically positioning myself in the proper way. Like, the thing that fundamentally outraged me when I was a young man, I'm an old man now, was the fundamental just unfairness and the daily humiliations that these Jews put these people through. And then you start seeing, well, there's echoes of that in our own lives in America, in a much, much less obviously violent and immediately dangerous context. But you see the way positions are excluded, the way narratives are handled, the way everything is, you know, everything is made way for the Jewish narrative, and anything that's not that is shoved out of the way. You know, everyone knows what I'm talking about. Sorry, I lost my train of thought there for a second.
I would like to talk about the actual fighters of Al-Qassam brigades. They were and a army of orphans that have lived their entire lives in effectively a prison camp surveilled by flying death robots that could arbitrarily and capriciously blow any of them up at any one time. They are never actually able to physically see IDF forces from the Gaza Strip. There's a series of microphones and cameras that occasionally would direct them. They, you know, guns on automated turrets surveilling them. These men live their entire lives, and the vast majority of them are between the ages of, you know, 16 and 22, that live a totally closed off strip. They know almost nothing but this strip and what they've lived under. They were able and are still able. People will say, oh, but the strip has been destroyed. Oh, but so many civilians have been killed. In this moment, 2 years on, there is this impression in Western media that the strip is fully occupied by the IDF and that the force of Qassam are simply, you know, it's a few hundred men underground, like digging through tunnels to occasionally, you know, attempt to ambush a tank, right? That's not true. It's simply untrue. They have absolutely shattered the myth of the IDF. There are, as we speak now, currently neighborhoods, currently front lines. There are currently places where Hamas and the Al-Qassam brigades are running civil government institutions, police forces, jails. They are doing law enforcement. There are parts of the strip right now, as we speak, that they control. There is a front line in Gaza. They have managed with light weapons to fight the IDF to an absolute standstill, and they have shattered the myth of the IDF being anything approaching what you call a competent land army. They have exposed the IDF as just simply another of many well-equipped, well-lauded Arab armies, in the same way that Saddam's armies, which were shattered, the myth of Saddam's armies was shattered so, you know, brutally. The fact that their own army shattered the myth of, you know, the Egyptian military. They are so wildly overperforming anyone, any analyst, including myself, expectations of what they could have achieved, what they continue to achieve in a military sense. And the fact that the Jewish forces have had to result into just simply bombing with aircraft and artillery random formations of civilians to attempt to, in some ways, even the scales, when they can't even gather like the courage to make an operation to enter the tunnels to fight Al-Qassam. So I want to stress there's this impression that, oh, this was some kind of heroic, Don Quixote, you know, toast, you know, ultimately futile toast, like tilt against windmills. No, they are currently in a stalemate with a regular Western style American equipped army. By all intents and purposes, they are in fact winning when the Israelis in their current offensive couldn't even call up the requisite forces to do their own operation. They suffered a 6,000 man shortfall in their call up. So I want to point out they are in fact winning.
Only six? I thought it was the number keeps going up every time
Yes. The original, you know, I'm going by the most pessimistic estimates. Yes, the original estimate was they need 50,000. That was revised down to 30,000. actually 24,000 showed up with a 6,000 shortfall. Well, yes, you could measure that shortfall.
They needed 80,000 to occupy Gaza City. And that's another funny thing. You mentioned the places in the Gaza Strip that had they had restored civil government. And Gaza City, the Jews had wanted to clear it out. Like, that was kind of number one.
Oh, yes. Today was supposed
untouched for almost a year.
The Jews got very mad at this space they heard we were celebrating, and they planned Operations Gideon's Chariots. The plan was to control central Gaza City by October 7th of this year. They have failed. Central Gaza City is still in the hands of Hamas. They could not push them back. On the ground.
Operation Gideon Chariots was they actually canceled that just before they then did their Gideon Chariots 2, which was the invasion of Gaza City. Before that, which was started again, I think at the end of August, beginning of September, there have been dozens of deaths in the Jewish army and probably hundreds of casualties resulting from this. They don't broadcast it, but you can see it if you follow the Telegram channels. And they had, before that, their last time attempting to physically enter Gaza City on the ground was in July of 2024 when they were chased out then. And so the idea that Hamas has been defeated, well, that can't be if we have this Donald Trump peace plan, the number one goal of which is Hamas has to surrender and disarm. 2 years into a war, you don't have a demand like that, and you don't even have a negotiation process if you have destroyed the enemy. And frankly, if the Jews had destroyed Hamas, they had eliminated all of them, killed everyone. First of all, the idea that you're going to kill every soldier in an army as your military goal going is stupid. Like, that's just not how a real army thinks about how a military goal is. That, and it's so Jewish, right? Only Jews would have this kind of, we're going to kill every member of their army. Like, that's not actually what your military goal is supposed to be. That's silliness, right? That's
it appeals to Americans, though, which is a big part of this propaganda problem.
I just want to point out something Mike said before. You know, he said genocide is a Jewish concept and a blood libel. Don't forget, blood libel is also a Jewish concept. In fact, scapegoating is also a Jewish concept. Basically, the entire vocabulary of victimization supposedly perpetrated against Jews are all things that Jews, in fact, thought of first, right down to, in many cases, the terms. Secondly, you know, when it comes to the Israelis losing, this is difficult for Americans to appreciate because they think of war, they think of victory in terms of how many people are killed, how many civilians can be massacred. We see this, you know, based on their stories of World War II and so on. But you know, all of these people that fashion themselves as, you know, Starship Troopers readers, von Clausewitz enjoyers, the point of war is to accomplish a political objective. You know, there's a scene in the movie, you know, why would we throw a knife when we can hit him with a nuke? And Career Sergeant Zim explains, you know, the point of violence is for a purpose. It's to make people do what your government wants by force. And the IDF is incapable of accomplishing political objectives, partially because the political objectives of the Israeli government are completely insane, fantastical, genocidal. Perhaps in the hands of some more rational government, some more normal government, some more normal people, the IDF could accomplish political objectives. We will actually literally never know the answer to that question, because right now the political aims of the Israeli government are that they get to commit genocide and nobody complains about it. And there's just no army that's going to make that happen.
That's how Americans think as well. It's all or nothing. They can't think in any kind of matter of nuance whatsoever. Well,
that's because of decades of Jewish mind poison.
Oh yeah, I mean they're Judaized. They're America. Like this is the most difficult thing for American nationalists, and most of them are in denial of this. But if you're an American nationalist, you're a Judaized nationalist. If you accept America as it is, you're a Judaized nationalist. That's just how it is.
Yeah, and it's just The thing is, it's like, yeah, I do get people who maybe take a second look at it and like, but, you know, look at all the destruction that has happened and look at everybody that's died. I just say to them, I hope that in the end, we, the rest of the people of the world, prove to have been worth it.
And people who cry about Cracker Barrel, don't get an opinion on this whatsoever. if you have an opinion on Cracker Barrel's logo, you don't get an opinion.
Yeah, if that was a win,
Cracker Barrel was a win for you. Immediately discarded.
Yeah, there's no, then you might as well just not talk about it. But yeah, I mean, I think that it's not really my place to second guess or whatever. I would like to, I too get following this day to day and during the initial stages of the hunger blockade starting around May, when no one else was talking about it, but I knew about it. And when the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which was the Trump thing that was actually like led, they found actually like a lot of these mercenaries or pro-Israel Christian Zionist mercenaries that were going there. Now, thank God for men like Anthony Aguilar and others who blew the whistle on this and came out and took video and revealed it. But this became like killing grounds and traps. And
yes, well, this was something that me and you,
Lewis knows, we were following this when it first started, and I was so depressed because I was like, dude, there's like 200 people getting killed every day, and we can't do anything about it. But
I will point out that I did somewhat predict that actually the problem is, you mentioned, you know, a little bright spot for the Americans in the audience is that you did mention, yes, Americans are like fundamentally Judaized in how we look at war being this all or nothing, total victory, total submission, surrender aspect. But we did predict that actually American soldiers are not fundamentally Jews, right? They will see these things and report them. And I think we predicted that American soldiers would not defect, but like, you know, break solidarity with the IDF doing this stuff to people, because Americans are fundamentally more decent than like actual IDF soldiers, and you know, very, you know, in a way that was, I think, reassuring. And it's something
a guy like Aguilar was trained in all of this stuff and took it seriously at West Point, right? Like, he took his classes in international law seriously, and the, you know, whatever courses he had to complete in this stuff, and like his training in this as a military, he took that all seriously. And he was like, you can tell from the guy, like listening to the guy, that he's not like, he probably was a ball breaker. And that, like, that's the thing that a lot of people were, oh, his men didn't like him. Like, well, cry me a river. Like, what? Okay. So the guys under his command didn't like him. Who cares? But, there is that aspect of the American military, and that the grunts, the ground forces don't do, like, there have been incidents. I'm not going to say there haven't been. There were some incidents in Iraq and Afghanistan, some incidents in Vietnam of bad command, people getting ahead of themselves and massacres being committed. But it is not a character of the ground forces. I'm not talking about the Air Force. That's a totally different thing. And then we talk about the aerial bombardment of Germany in the Second World War, that was absolutely targeting civilians on purpose. Even then, though, you saw lots of American pilots didn't like their orders. They didn't like the orders they were getting, because they're like, wait, so we're doing daylight bombing of factories? Like, the only reason to do this is just to kill workers. And like, yeah, kill workers. That's the idea. We're going to be killing workers, right?
Well, so, Arthur Harris actually put out a report. This is a little bit far field. Well, but he did put out a report where he was complaining that the British government had not publicized the area bombing directive. And so the British public thought that the bombings, or that the destruction they were seeing, was like byproduct of attempts to hit factories. And he said, the government needs to make clear that I'm not bad at my job, right? The goal is to sow terror. The goal is to kill people. The goal is to cause homelessness. And right now what they think is that we are bad at knowing where an armament workshop is. I also want to emphasize, oh, another thing. The German, the modern Bundeswehr had a similar problem, the current German army, where they were bringing in Ukrainians to train, and every German soldier, I'm sure they spend maybe 20% of their time, learn probably 80%, frankly, on how to avoid personal culpability for war crimes, how to refuse lawful orders, and of course, how to sniff out hate symbols. And they had a problem where, as they were training Azov guys would be, of course, you know, they have their Sonnenrads, but they're also talking about committing Geneva Conventions violations. And the Bundeswehr, like, wasn't really sure how to accommodate this, because soldiers were like, oh, okay, I know I'm obliged to snitch when I see this happening.
That's kind of funny, actually. It's like, yeah, can you imagine? Yeah, that's actually another predictable. I didn't know about that, but that's so predictable that would happen. That when you actually,
I should also emphasize, apparently our host is having some connection issues, so it's entirely possible that this space may blink out. We will, of course, try to bring it back immediately. Just letting people know to be wary of that.
I think we're good. I think it's just like, sometimes if the space gets a little too big on my internet, you know.
That's why we do it on your computer, not your phone.
I'm on my computer.
I know. I'm just saying, like, imagine on your phone how much of a nightmare this would be. The other point is, I really want to emphasize just how much, in the immediate sense, Israel invited October 7th by any reasonable moral judgment. So first, there was the fact that, you know, in the late 2010s, the people of Gaza were conducting peaceful protests, things like the March of Return, where citizens, where journalists and medics would all be shot as they approached the border, the so-called border fence, a security barrier, whatever it is they call it. That on its own, right? The shooting of peaceful protesters near the security barrier on what is supposed to be the other side of a zone from which you've withdrawn is an act of war which justifies an armed Hamas response instantly. But then second to that, the installation of Itamar Ben-Gvir as the national security minister and his arming of inbred Jewish settlers as a terror militia. You know, I don't like to make Jews the primary victims, but we have seen in the case of, oh no, I've forgotten his name. In any case, there was a Jewish guy in Jerusalem who, during a shooting at a bus stop, he himself then shot the Palestinian perpetrating it. And then he was in turn shot by a settler who then boasted to the media that he was happy to finally get a notch on his rifle. And the entire time, this Jewish guy who had shot the first Palestinian who was committing an action, he was begging the first responder, please help me, I'm Jewish. Please take my wallet, I'm Jewish. And they wouldn't. Yuval Castleman was his name. Yuval Castleman. You know, please help me, I'm Jewish. And that still wouldn't happen. So Itamar Ben-Gvir has unleashed an army of people that are just happy to kill. They are, of course, primarily, intentionally focused on killing Palestinians. But these are also, and they happen to be, the kind of crazy people that will also just kill Jews for fun if they think they can get away with it.
Well,
so when someone like that is put in charge of the West Bank, that justifies war.
And he also, the other thing is, one of the reasons that there's another myth out there, and I know this is a popular one, and I know people that do this, and I'm telling you, like, conspiracy theories, false flag stuff, like, there's some stuff that I think, you know, that falls under that banner, but, you know, you can't systematically assume everything is like that. And the Jewish invincibility thing, the idea that they let this happen, they staged it. There's a couple of different phases of this. One is the idea that Israel created or funded Hamas. That requires an extreme stretch of the idea of created and funded. And in the end, this is a labor Zionist complaint, which is meant as a shot at Netanyahu and his government. And you'll notice that many of the people that have originated this claim are officials, ex-labor generals of the IDF that are affiliated with the Israeli Labor Party that have made these claims about when they were governing Gaza in the 70s. And what ultimately became Hamas, the Islamic movement in Gaza that ultimately became Hamas, they just didn't shut it down. They allowed them to have mosques and to open an Islamic university and then to also collect donations from other Arabs and other states. Other Arab states were allowed to give money to them. And they just didn't shut this down. So my question, what for those, and leftists, you'll see leftists will repeat this, like, oh, Israel created Hamas. They never funded. There's no evidence of a single dollar or a single shekel of Jewish money going into the pockets of anybody in Hamas. So I would ask any liberal leftist that is making this claim, because this is very much a claim of that, because they resent the fact that the Palestinian resistance takes on an Islamic character rather than a secular character like the PLO, which ended up becoming the Palestinian Authority and becoming complicit. I would ask them, so do you think that the Jews should have shut down the religious expression of the people in the Gaza Strip in the 1970s? Because that's what you're effectively asking them to do. That's what you're suggesting they had failed to do by the, and that is now considered like funding or creating Hamas. So that's what they mean by that. They just said Israel allowed Sheikh Yassin, who became the spiritual founder of Hamas, to just run mosques and a university. They just let that happen, okay? Now, there are Jews that actually themselves internally from their own side could be like, well, yeah, we shouldn't have done that, right? If you're a Jew, you can understand that criticism. But if you're like a leftist that's supposedly pro-Palestine, I really don't understand that criticism at all, because you're just suggesting that Jews should have shut down religious freedom.
Yes. Well, there's another similar conspiracy that kind of revolt. It's, you know, you see it less. I would say it's more of the right-wing conspiracy, if we were to kind of categorize these, of October 7th, which is that
the IDF is so powerful yes. and competent and
there's no way.
Good at their jobs yeah. and handsome and masculine or whatever adjective, you know, superlatives, right wingers want to apply to the IDF, that for some reason that any kind of raid or attack from the strip would have immediately been intercepted and shot down. This is frankly like it's also like kind of almost movies and video game ideas of like, well, like as if getting out of the Gaza Strip was a matter of like Ocean's 11, like around to hopping around lasers and you know, hacking and like hacking into walls and doing all kind of, you know, bizarre activities, when in fact it was simply just an infantry like raid. You know, they had three bases on the border. They were raided in a very, very traditional, very conventional, Western style, actually, like infantry raid. The same thing that would be taught at like the American Ranger School. You would be taught this. So it would be very normal kind of raid tactics that were employed here. And they didn't need to disable anything fancy. They simply took explosives up to the wall of the prison and detonated the explosives. It wasn't high art here. It was simply like one thing is that the Jewish power, even in the West, it requires this view of Jewish invincibility and like inevitability. The thing is, once you actually get into action, it's, you know, some of us have experienced, if you ever went to these like genocide protests, is that you would see these IDF guys roll up and like be all like, oh, like they're going to like get you to leave, and then you simply like, well, actually I'm not leaving, and then they just kind of get surly and occasionally come over and try to shove you, you know, like once you just stand up to them, the scales fall from your eyes and you realize, oh, they're nothing. And there's frankly, the IDF is relatively small. They lost at minimum between 1,000 and 2,000, at least 2 battalions of troops were lost. No military, there's not one inside the IDF, is giving up 2 entire battalions of capability of like casus belli. The idea that the Jews needed an excuse to bomb Gaza when they had already been bombing Gaza periodically and like running raids into it.
Yeah.
It's absurd. And frankly, the IDF was massively tied up in the West Bank for the last 2 to 3 years under Ben-Gvir, supporting, because the psycho like settler inbreds couldn't effectively, like, they would just get in over their heads whenever they tried to go, like, you know, humiliate Palestinians and intercept Palestinians. So the IDF had to actually pull off troops from Gaza to like support these psycho militias. Like, the IDF prior to this incident was massively undermanned and stretched very thin. They are not giving up 2 battalions of troops.
An early adopter, by the way, it's kind of funny, an early adopter of the theory that Israel had somehow let it happen was Charlie Kirk. Charlie Kirk was gushing about how when he went to Gaza or when he went to Israel, you know, he said, you know, the IDF has the most sophisticated surveillance apparatus in the world, and I almost don't believe that they couldn't have seen it coming somehow. But it is crucial to understand, like, if this is missing from your analysis, you will be confused. The IDF was not missing. They were there for those first 12 hours. They were killing everything in sight. The Hannibal directive accounts for those first, you know, 8 to 12 hours where seemingly they can't account for their actions. What their actions were was creating that highway of death, was blowing up vehicles, blowing up houses, those rows of burned out buildings. You think RPG-7s were destroying entire neighborhoods? Wrong. These were Israeli helicopters.
Yeah, I mean, I always think about the parking lot at Nova, right? Which it's like, yeah, Palestinians have, they could in theory blow up that many cars with RPGs or even with some of the rockets that they have, which are pretty inaccurate. Like, they don't have sophisticated targeting technologies on their rockets. They kind of just spray and pray, but which again doesn't matter. There's no invalid target inside Israel. But the concentration of that destruction, those were Israeli missiles. Like, those were Hellfire missiles from helicopters or something like that, that caused that many cars. It's just, you don't, like, Yassin shells are not going to do that. RPGs are not going to do that. AKs are not going to do that. So, you know, there, if you want to do a conspiracy of the Jews did it, you have one, which is this Hannibal directive narrative, which is, that's just true. And, you know, one of the Jewish women, again, not to make Jews, not to center their experiences, but one of the chubby Jewish girls that was rescued, and she gave an interview to Israeli TV, and she said that actually when she was being kidnapped, kidnapped or captured. She was a legitimate, she was a soldier. She was an in-uniform soldier. She is a legitimate target for capture by the enemy, right? They are prisoners of war. They are not hostages. They are not. So I always have to check myself and make sure I say prisoners of war. And Jews have actually gotten mad at me about that on Twitter for using those terms. But, and because they're teenage girls, they expect you to be, anyway, I'm sorry, Jews, if you're going to put teenage girls in IDF uniforms, it's on you, right? That's your problem. So she was saying, though, to Israeli TV that she was most worried that she was going to get killed by their own side. Because she knew that despite the fact that they don't talk about it, that there are obviously, if we are talking about it here in Israel, the rumors are flying of how many people on October 7th were really killed by the IDF. Then they don't really want to talk about it. They don't want to think about it. But you know, this girl said that she was worried about it while she was being carried to her prison in Gaza. So that's definitely true. So if you want some kind of conspiracy theory, that's right there. There you have it. But the idea that they would allow this to happen, again, yeah, you don't allow that level of damage to be done, particularly not Israel, right? Like, if you want to talk about 9/11, like, that's not damage directly to Israel, right? That's us. They don't really care so much about that. So, like, we're expendable. Like, we are all expendable to them, right? So, who cares?
I do want to ask you questions for, since Garamar, Jose, and Josh haven't talked whole time. Although, Borza, what did you want to?
Oh, no, I was actually doing what you were about to do. Is like, I wanted to get these other people.
Perfect.
I was going to say, like, I wanted to hear perfect. I wanted to hear initial reactions to all this stuff. But you go ahead. You're a better presenter than I am.
So, Garamar. So, technically, Garamar is an industrial chemist, though he's a genocide scholar, sort of, by necessity. So I was wondering, since you feed him a question, Garamar, could you elaborate, if you can, on the difference between what we would call a siege bombardment versus a terror bombing? And maybe what the morally relevant difference is here. Because I described it earlier as, you know, the first aerial genocide, you know, deliberately targeting schools, hospitals, bakeries, which is something that, as far as I know, even America technically hadn't done when it was bombing Japan. You know, we were just that was a true indiscriminate bombing, from my understanding. Even, you know, bombing Dresden, that was a true indiscriminate bombing. But it seems as though Israel is discriminatorily bombing civilian targets specifically. I was wondering if you could talk about that.
The idea of non-fortified cities is actually one that comes from still from the medieval ages, and it became international law, I think, before the First World War, at a time when there was no air force, when there was no aerial bombardment. But the concept has actually survived that even if you have an air force, you can't indiscriminately bomb civilian targets. You can target specifically military targets, like munitions factories and airfields and in general and things like that, even if they are far behind the front lines, but specifically targeting anything that is non-military related, you're not allowed to. Now, of course, in Gaza, the situation is once a city is at war with a state that neighbors it, the whole city becomes a battleground to one degree or another, and the lines blur. But then today, the ability of being specific with targeting methods, during the Second World War, they were relatively bad still at hitting specific targets. So they resorted to the carpet bombing just to kill everything. And they could not, as we can today with the weapons we have, target specific factories. Now, the excuse doesn't exist anymore. The IDF forces have the means to target specifically military objects. Now, are there specific dedicated military objects from Hamas in that area? Gaza is not a military city. It doesn't have any official military site. So the line is really blurred, but it is also used then by the Jewish state, because it's blurred, to excuse everything they're doing and coming up with the idea that Hamas is using civilians as shields. That may be the case here and there. I don't know. I'm not on the ground. In military conflict, that happens. Even if it's forbidden by superiors, some lower-ranking people in the heat of the battle may still do it. But then again, using that as an excuse to indiscriminately bombing everything, that's not helping.
We have seen...
At the end of it, it's not helping your own goal because you are unifying your enemy with the atrocities you're committing.
We've seen that Israel can hit targets with accuracy because when Israel bombed, it was a vehicle belonging to the World Central Kitchen, and it showed the strike hitting the car. And I remember the logo of World Central Kitchen, as you can imagine, is a globe. It's a circle. And the strike that hit the vehicle literally hit it dead center bullseye. I was almost impressed when I saw it. As for the matter of, is it possible that Hamas uses human shields? So we have seen reports of what Israel considers to be using human shields. And one of them is, for example, they say, oh, Hamas fighters transport themselves in ambulances. And when you read the incident report, they're transported in ambulances to hospitals. So it's not as though fighters are being delivered to battlefields in ambulances. Rather, what happens is they become wounded in battle. There are ambulances that are gathering civilians, and then they attempt to board those ambulances to return to get medical care. And we've seen that Israel considers Hamas fighters recovering inside hospitals to be valid targets and to make the entire hospital suspect. In some cases, the Jews have disguised themselves as doctors, as if there weren't enough Jewish real doctors, right? Disguise themselves as doctors to carry out commando raids and shoot people in their hospital beds. Likewise, they had said that Al-Shifa Hospital was supposedly Hamas headquarters because the health minister, right? They said since the health minister is in the hospital, that's a Hamas official inside the hospital, and that justifies its being destroyed.
Israel does this thing with propaganda about Hamas, civilians, human shields, and medical care, etc., and hospitals, where they, you know, Israel, when their soldiers are wounded, they air evacuate them to hospitals inside of Israel. And sometimes they even clear out civilians from the emergency rooms if there's a bad ambush or something and a bunch of, like, dozens of Jewish troops need to go into the... So they do this? So can Hamas now blow those hospitals up? Would that be accepted? Yeah. So it's important to understand the totally hypocritical double standard that they apply is if you are in Hamas, you are basically... This is the way they talk about it. You are not allowed to, like, touch anything. Because if you touch something, it becomes a valid... target. Now, is this the case in Israel, right? Would they accept this in Israel? Like, there's military infrastructure.
Well, luckily, we do actually have the answer to this question because, I'm not Gemara Rudolph, but I'm more familiar with law of armed conflict, from my background. And the law of armed conflict is very clear in that there's a concept of a civilian hospital and a military hospital in, like, how we talk, right? In theory, Walter Reed Hospital is a military hospital. The doctors there are, like, paid by the U.S. Army or whatever. There is no such concept in military law. There is no action a hospital can take in terms of treatment that can make it a legitimate target. There is no type of personnel present that make it a legitimate target. This is well precedent, well studied. Hospitals are hospitals under international law and the law of armed conflict. The only time it is ever acceptable to shoot at a hospital is in self-defense. So the only time I can shoot at a hospital is if someone is in the hospital shooting me and I can, like, see them, and then I have to also be discriminate. I can't just bomb the whole thing. I need to shoot back. There's no such designation. Even if a hospital was in theory, say if there was a hospital that was an ammunition dump, right? Half of the hospital was filled with, like, ammunition for Hamas or for Israel. You still don't get the right to strike it. Actually.
Yes.
At that point, that is the enemy is violating international law. But you do not gain the right to bomb.
I think the only distinction that we made would be if, for example, Walter Reed himself, the person, right, the army doctor, I think if he was captured and he said, I'm a civilian doctor, I think you say, no, you're qualified as POW. You see?
Yes, but even so, a military doctor captured has to be given the right to treat other POWs.
Yes.
That is a right he has. So, yes, he can't say, let me go, I'm a civilian, but he can say, let me go, effectively be. He will agree, okay, I won't try to escape. Let me treat my fellow POWs. And even, he could also be required to treat his captors.
Yes.
He is a resource to be used by the capturing force in that prisoner of war camp.
Josh.
Oh, sorry. Oh. I had a question for Lewis.
I wanted to ask Josh a question since he hasn't spoken this whole time.
Okay.
So actually, I can ask you a few questions. We could either connect your work on extremism and radicalization to West Bank militias, or I could ask you about the proliferation of conspiracy theories, or in this case, fake conspiracy theories about Jewish competence. I'll let you take your pick on what you want to talk about.
Well, not to sidestep both of those topics, just on what Mike was saying before about the double standards that Israel employs that allows them to use any justification to massacre Palestinians. It's what's interesting, and this relates to American politics within conservatism and the radical right, is the way in which, and I don't know that they use this language explicitly, but they're very much operating under this, the kind of Schmittian idea of the total enemy, total enmity, that this is an existential challenge, that the presence of the Palestinians, of a Palestinian, poses an existential threat to every Jewish person in the territory, and so that grants them the moral license to do whatever it is that they want to do, to be as barbaric and savage as they are. So yeah, on the one hand, it's obviously a hypocritical and a double standard, but I think it speaks to the what is psychologically nearest to the Jewish people, and in this case, Israel, which is that existentialist total enemy perspective. And as that relates to the American scene and how we've seen, you know, Mike and Borzoi and the TRS and Antelope Hill guys have done a lot of posting about this, you know, the both sides guys. The phenomenon of both sides guys, where I don't care what happens to the brown people and I don't care about what happens to the Jews, but I really hope the Jews kill all of the brown people, is the way in the last 5 years that Schmittian thinking has become predominant among nationalists, people in the hard right, national conservatives, such that, and this dovetails with, you know, I think you were saying in your monologue, you know, if you're criticizing Israel, that's leftist. It's all of these sort of abstract heuristical categories that don't have concrete reference, you know, brown coded. We're like, it's important when you're speaking and thinking that the concepts you employ map to actually existing social and material realities. If I say, oh, it's those damn libertarians, well, we know who that refers to. We know where libertarianism proliferates. We know we can genealogically examine the history of libertarianism. You can't do that with these ideas, or at least not in the way that they employ them, these elastic ideas of leftism and third worldism and brown coded. They don't map cleanly to transparent, obvious social realities. You can't do a sort of investigation. Or it would be more complicated by the fact that they use these terms so liberally. You can't just identify, well, where are the third worldists? What institutions do they dominate? What ideologies do they disseminate to recruit more third worldists? If you criticize Israel, if you have anything to say, even tepidly, if you have anything, if you express outrage or frustration even about, for example, Israel indiscriminately killing Al Jazeera journalists. Well, that's leftism. And that makes you an enemy in this friend-enemy paradigm. And that's how they shut out the conversation. That's how they reinforce the groupthink. And that's how they maintain this sort of Jewish-heavy hegemony within the right wing in America. So it's just interesting to me that all of these Schmittian ideals work very well with clearly the Jewish psychology.
The journalist thing, I guess we can finally segue into the main part or the sort of the other half of what this space is about. So besides how bad Israelis are, right, the subversion of the right. So as I mentioned before, like every single right-wing narrative was twisted. Well, I didn't want to say twisted. Perhaps that's what they were for in the first place. it was activated, was mobilized, was oriented towards defending Jews. And the one that jumps out to me the most was Orrin McIntyre saying, you know, you don't hate journalists enough. You think you do, but you don't. You know, first of all, Orrin McIntyre is a journalist.
Yeah, yeah.
He works for Glenn Beck. Literally works for Glenn Beck. But secondly, you know, when Israel is killing Al Jazeera journalists in Gaza, like Arab journalists in an Arab territory defending Arab people, somehow that is seen as moral equivalent to, you know, what McIntyre called communists, right? Commie journalists, commie Jewish journalists in America convincing you to cut off your kid's dick. And they were saying that, you know, why are you sympathizing with journalists? I remember even I myself, when it happened, I was about to make a post about it, and I said to myself, ha, journalists. And I said, what the fuck is wrong with me? Where did that enter my mind? And I remembered, like, right, it's a huge meme in this area. And I think we can bring in Jose on that question, since Jose is, you know, pretty well affiliated, or well, you know, he works with the Barnes Review and does a lot of freaking stuff on the far right.
Journalist.
Yeah, Jose's a journalist. I mean, basically, we're all journalists. I mean, well, I'm not exactly, but those of, you know, for those of us who make our living or do anything even vaguely related to writing down our words, disseminating ideas, you know, proliferating news of events, we are journalists. You know, even these thought leaders, what, I mean, BAP is effectively, to the extent that he's not an author or just, you know, a court intellectual, he is a journalist. He runs a podcast. He talks about the news. That's journalism.
No, I agree with that, that it's just shows the revealed policy preference of defending Jewish supremacy at that point, because everybody in this game, especially you put pen to paper or have put out content on politics, you're effectively acting as a journalist. And to, and when you're not in the traditional political sphere, one of the strongest tools at your disposal is exposing and disseminating information about this conflict. So I just see the both sides guy type narratives and also these weird rightoid narratives. These are just very over elaborate ways to just defend Israel. These people might as well just be honest and just say like they're defending Jewish interests at this point, because, or just sit this one out. Honestly, like for like both sides guys, I think like if the most productive thing they could do is just sit out this debate instead of signaling that you're a both sides guy, which is just another way for them to tell potential Jewish donors that they could be paid to look the other way or receive money behind the scenes to advance Jewish interests.
And that's the crucial difference between us and both sides guys, right? Because some people say, well, you know, they're supporting Israel, you're supporting Palestine. What's the difference? The difference is, right, we say point blank, we support Palestine. We hate Israel. We don't pretend to be morally deformed weirdos. We don't pretend that we're trying to be even worse people than we were yesterday. But that is what these people do. They are constantly... Go ahead.
If I may chip in what Josh said about the absolute enemy, that touches upon what I've been... I'm starting to understand or wrap my head around lately much more intensely. I think there are two main pillars for the Jewish, or more specifically the Zionist community, particularly the Jewish Zionist community, why they have this absolute enemy approach. The first one is traditional. That is simply based on the book of Joshua, the conquest, the biblical conquest, the fable of the biblical conquest of the Holy Land, where God orders, whatever you, if you can call that a God, orders the Jewish people to ethnically cleanse the Holy Land, commit one genocide after another. And this is something that some Orthodox and fundamentalist rabbis and politicians in Israel in that conflict have actually pointed out. We're just basically repeating what is written in the Bible and is said to have occurred 3,000 years ago or whatever. So that's the religious, the traditional pillar that is supported by the Orthodox and fundamentalist aspect of the Jewish community. But then you have, of course, what has been referred to as experience, modern experience. And I must say that any Jew who has influence and is active today cannot claim for himself experience in this quote-unquote Holocaust. It has been depicted as the world's most heinous crime, and the Jews has been depicted as the ultimate victim of that crime. But this is 80 years ago, 80 plus years ago, and the generation who has any kind of experience with it and can remember it is now 90 plus year old, and they're not active in any regard anymore. Anyone who's acting today cannot claim personal experience, but what they do have is generational traumatization and re-traumatization by indoctrination with a historical narrative from kindergarten on. And there was actually a discussion in Israel in 2014 when they changed their curriculum for the schools, starting to teach children about the Holocaust, not in school, but already in kindergarten. And there were quite a few parents who were opposed to that, 4 or 5 year old kids getting traumatized that early with a narrative that we Jews are eternally the potential target of this absolute horror and it can hit you. And tomorrow some guy around the corner can do that to you, build up a gas chamber, stuff you in there. This creates paranoia. This creates a people that is traumatized because of their upbringing. And these double pillars is leading to what we see in the society in Israel, in the Jewish community in general. And I must say, you know, how do we explain that the people in Europe are against what's going on, but the politicians anti-democratically push the unconditional support of what Israel is doing anyhow, and any opposition in the streets? We have seen that in the UK, where hundreds of people got arrested. We've seen it in Germany that has actually, well, they have sweeping censorship law, not only against Holocaust skepticism, not only against massive immigration, but now, of course, also against criticizing what Israel is doing in Gaza. You can't go to prison for that. How is that explained? And to my experience is that the more educated, in particular, the more quote-unquote left-wing educated you are, the more you have gone in Germany, as the second worst indoctrinated country in the world, Israel is the first in particular, but in general in the Western world, you go through the education where you get also indoctrinated with this Holocaust narrative, this overinflated, partially invented, completely distorted story of total horror and absolute evil. And then it is a Pavlovian reflex of these leaders, of these brainwashed Pavlovian dogs, to have this knee-jerk reaction. It is psychologically completely logical. And the only healing that Jews, as well as non-Jews alike, that have been traumatized with this can find is stop the traumatization. I actually was married until not too long ago to a psychologist who was a trauma expert. And one of the things that I've learned in that marriage is the way to cope with trauma is not to constantly look back, not to relive the trauma, but to find new ground where you're safe from triggers that cause you to memorize and relive these things, and to find safety and distraction and normalcy somewhere. What is happening is the exact opposite, particularly in the Israeli state, but everywhere in the West, basically, because Holocaust education is compulsory pretty much everywhere in the Western world. The exact opposite, traumatized from kindergarten on over and over and over again. And with so doing, you create paranoid people who suspect under every rock a guy who wants to shove them into a gas chamber, who then consider it pivotal for their survival because they are so paranoid to preemptively kill anything that's in their way. This is the policy we see that Netanyahu is pushing for. This is what Western leader, unfortunately, with their own knee-jerk reaction, plus their anxiety, their fear of the third rail and Jewish influence being able to ruin their career, to go along with this against popular expectations or demands or wishes.
I'll pass it to Josh to talk more about, you know, trauma response. But don't forget, also, Judaism is an insane Kafka trap double bind, because the number two threat is that the goy is like lying in wait to kill you. But don't forget, the number one threat is that the goy might be your friend and try to marry you and assimilate with you. And then if you do that, then God will punish you. He'll send you into exile. You know, it's basically a genocide unto itself. I actually remember it was a TikTok video of a woman who was saying, you know, she was crying about all the things Jews have done with the world. And he said, you know, and what did the world give us back but genocide and assimilation? As though, you know, the hand extended out in friendship to Jews, or, you know, I suppose the reproductive organ extended, you know, in the desire of mixing, is also just as much a threat worthy of violent response. It's also bonkers that, you know, as Israel becomes, you know, Itamar Ben-Gvir does not have ancestors that were even allegedly victimized by the Holocaust. You know, these Mizrahim, although I'm sure there is some mixing with Ashkenazim, you know, these Mizrahim have no putative experience with this, you know, supposed genocide that the Jews suffered. Yet they manifest an even worse hostility.
Just very quickly, assimilation as genocide is literally the Dara Horn people love dead Jews position. That's all I want to say.
I mean, hopefully Kevin will join us soon because this is sort of his expertise.
Something horrible is happening to your microphone right now.
I'll
get that. Get that. I got Dr. Rudolph, if I could ask you a question real quick. You mentioned almost at the beginning of the space about, like, you know, how there's this mythos about the Holocaust being one of the most documented genocides to ever happen. And then you know, obviously what's happening in Palestine is very documented. We have footage almost coming out every day. I was going to ask, if we had footage that was comparable in what's happening in Palestine, in Germany in the years of 1940 to 1945, what would the Holocaust mythos actually look like in contemporary times? Like, do you think, would people actually believe that, like, 6 million people died in the Holocaust if we had the type of evidence that we have in Palestine right now existing in Germany during those years?
I would be completely speculating about this if we had not such massive amounts of documentation and of material evidence to actually pretty much know what has happened and can exclude on the basis of technical possibilities and natural laws and all kind of material evidence what cannot have happened. So if I'm saying the mainstream calls the Holocaust the best documented genocide in history, my reaction to that is, yes, it is the best documented genocide in history. Now, genocide is a watered-down concept. It doesn't mean that you shove people into gas chambers and kill them. It just means you put them under circumstances where their procreation and their ethnic entity is threatened and is being damaged or destroyed. And this is something that the Jewish community in Europe no doubt experienced, whether there were gas chambers or not. It's a completely separate question. So if you look at this research that I have spearheaded, organized, published, and edited over the past 35 years, which is all freely accessible under holocausthandbooks.com. 54 volumes of hard-hitting documentary and forensic studies on every nook and cranny on the Holocaust. And if you don't want to read the 54 volumes, which I suggest is probably an overkill, go to the holocaustencyclopedia.com where you'll find all the summary and source references. It is indeed the best documented event, if you want to call it genocide or not, it's a matter of taste more than anything in the history of mankind, but not because of what the mainstream has done, which basically have fudged the record and ignored the massive amount of material evidence and documentary evidence that has come down to us ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union. If you look at what the situation is, and there is healing for the entire world, including the Jewish community, it turns out that what we have been told has been twisted, distorted, exaggerated into no small degree invented, particularly when it comes to the iconic murder weapon of the Holocaust, the so-called gas chambers. They are a complete figment of the imagination. That doesn't mean that Jews didn't suffer. They were deported. They were deprived of their civil rights. They ended up in concentration camps, forced labor camps. They were shoved into ghettos and conditions there were at times disastrous, not by design, but by neglect, circumstance of the war and so forth. Long story. we have the documents. We don't have 50, 80 years ago, people with cell phones and cameras documenting everything. I wish we had. My dream is, as a historian, to be a mouse, to be transferred back into time with a human understanding and ability to hear what's going on, and but not change the course of event, which you could do when you're in a mouse sitting in the corner, and then listen and see what really happened. But we've gotten a pretty good understanding. And if Jews, Zionists in general, would learn the lessons that we offer, the lesson is a good one for humanity. The absolute horror that we have been taught did not happen. There were bad things happened during that war. The Second World War was a series of genocides where everyone, the whole world tried to genocidally wipe Germany off the map, and that's why they fought back and they scapegoated, to use that term here. The Jews singled them out because they couldn't make threats in return against the entire world. That didn't make sense. So they singled out what they saw as the main instigator and the main force that caused hostility against them, which there is some good reasoning for that. But that's a different story. So, yeah, the documents are there, just not the film footage.
Oh, and our
we don't really, as a historian, we don't really need film footage to come to proper conclusions.
Our second keynote speaker has arrived. So just to remind everybody, Dr. Kevin MacDonald is the author of the Culture of Critique trilogy, that being A People That Shall Dwell Alone, Separation and Its Discontents, and then, of course, Culture of Critique, as well as I think his most recent book is called Individualism and the Western Liberal Tradition. Dr. Kevin MacDonald, thank you very much for joining us. Dr. Kevin MacDonald, the mute button is on the bottom left. It's a big red microphone.
Sorry. Glad to be here. I think one of the good results of the whole Gaza genocide, the horror over there, is that it's going to be very hard for Jews to portray them as victims all the time. I mean, they have really, you know, they're through a long history of conflict with every people they've ever lived upon. And this is what's going on in Palestine is no exception. But, you know, in this case, you know, their slaughters and the bombing and everything are all over TV, and who can not notice that? And they have lost a lot of support, especially among young people, and, you know, especially among liberal left people, but increasingly people on the right. You know, Charlie Kirk's a very big influencer, and he was giving it up right at the end. He turned down a whole lot of money, you know, that'd be hard for anyone to turn down. I just saw $2 million. I've seen other much larger figures. So I think people are waking up, you know, that Jews aren't as nice people that they have presented themselves. And the eternal victimology, it's just got to, that whole narrative has to suffer, with what is going on. I think it has suffered.
So, Dr. MacDonald, while we have you, so half of this space's topic is, of course, Jewish conduct since October 7th in Gaza, but the other half has been the seeming subversion of the entire right. Now, your book, your book series, is, I would say, one of the most deliberately misunderstood in our sphere. Most people who claim to have read your book have not read it. They listen to the so-called rebuttal by Nathan Koffness. They will say things like, what MacDonald doesn't realize is that Jews have high IQs, even though the entire point of your first book is to explain why Jews have high IQs, like in the literal Darwinistic sense, what caused that to happen. And worse still, the people who say, well, you know, Kevin MacDonald is, you know, he's just trying to force a simplistic answer. These people are quoting IQ stats literally from Richard Lynn. So I was wondering if you could just could you explain to us what the word Jewish intellectual movement, what we mean by that when we say this movement is Jewish? If I say neoconservatism is Jewish, for example, could you explain to us what that means?
Well, it's a movement where the major figures identify as Jews and see what they're doing as advancing Jewish interests. Get that, both of those. And, you know, talk about subverting the right. Certainly the neoconservatives have been in the lead of that. They have infiltrated the right in, you know, beginning in the 19, they were always on the left, way on the left. And then you started to have persecution in the Soviet Union and became big anti-communists with neoconservatives. And they essentially moved to, they infiltrated the Republican Party. And in my book and the chapter on neoconservatives, which is now a chapter, it wasn't before, but Sam Francis, who lived through this, has a great stories about how they pushed these traditional paleoconservatives out of the Reagan administration. And even things like Carl Gershman of the National Endowment for Democracy. And it was like total foreign intervention and funding all these NGOs. And the whole neoconservative thing was to move the Republican Party to the left, you know, so they became very friendly to immigration. And of course, the person who stood up for it was Pat Buchanan back in the 90s, and he ran for president and was getting quite successful. And Jews were freaking out about that because he was doubtful about some of the aspects of the Holocaust and certainly doubtful about Israel. And in the 1991 war, he was talking about the Amen Corner in Israel, the Jewish, you know, members of Congress and the media and everything.
When you say, so when you try to identify a movement as being a Jewish intellectual movement, do you simply say this movement has a lot of Jews in it, therefore it is Jewish?
No.
Is there a higher standard? What standard of evidence do you often use to demonstrate that this movement is Jewish?
It's a much higher standard. And now, especially with the third edition, you know, there's a lot more available online. So you can get, you know, Freud's letters, more of his letters, and you can get Franz Boas's letters. And you can see that their interest in Jewish activism, their strong Jewish identity, their association with activists. Boas's research was funded by Jewish, by wealthy Jews. So you see this network there. And of course, there are times, in especially if there's a lot of anti-Semitism, where Jews don't want to advertise, you know, I'm Jewish and you want to advertise their activism. But it was possible to really ferret out that the main figures were Jews who identified as Jews and who, you know, were attempting to advance Jewish interests, especially ending anti-Semitism.
So you're saying that with the internet, we can often just find these people's letters and they say things like, I'm doing this for the Jews, or even things like, hey, you should front up a Gentile. We don't want people to know that we're doing this for the Jews. Are you saying that they have letters like this you can just read?
Well, it's not as bold as that, but it's, you know, it's like, you know, associating with other Jewish activists, having an office along with the ADL, being in close connection with the ADL, that sort of thing. And, you know, you see during World War II and before, you see the activism, hatred towards Germany that these Frankfurt School people had and their intense involvement in Jewish affairs. But even before the war, it was strong and it was apparent. And it's more than IQ, always has been more than IQ. And for Kafka's to say that is a way, vast oversimplification. For one thing, at any level of IQ, there are way more non-Jewish white people at any given level of IQ. And say you take an IQ of 140, which is high enough to have any professional job in our economy, practically, you know, they're going to be like 7 to 1 in terms of non-Jews. So it's way more than that. It's partly Jewish personality, but certainly, and I wrote a lot more about Jewish personality in the revised edition, a lot of it is ethnocentrism, the ability to get on the same page, to form these cohesive groups that are effective and aggressive and assertive. I mean, you talk about aggressive. You know, it does go back to the Old Testament, you know, the genocides that are recorded there. But throughout history, Jews have been very aggressive. And you know, just the attempt to change the demographics of America, you know, is outrageously aggressive. The whole Israel lobby, AIPAC, in your face in Congress, where they, you know, they have minors for every congressman and all that. I mean, and, you know, trying to get our country, they've been the leaders, you know, getting our country to fight the Iraq war, being in Syria, and certainly now Iran. I do think that they are cranking up once again for a war in Iran. A lot of people are saying it. Just a question of time, and they will try their best to rope America in. And so far, Trump has been certainly not what we thought he might be. He's, you know, he was talking non-intervention, and a lot of neocons bailed on him. You know, people like Bill Kristol and Jennifer Rubin, Max Boot, they bailed on Trump because he was talk about non-intervention and ending the forever wars in the Middle East and all that, but also because Trump was saying things on immigration that neocons find abhorrent. So, you know, that it's been a journey, shall we say, getting all this material together. The third edition is 40% larger than the second edition.
And that third edition can be bought, and I'll open up the questions to everybody else, of course. So that third edition can be bought from Antelope Hill Publishing, which I've shared in the Jumbotron. Yeah. And a quick article recommendation. This article's not by yourself, Dr. McDonald, but a simple explanation for, or a relatively simple explication of this mismatch between, you know, the fact that Jews have a measurably higher IQ and yet are still outnumbered by Gentiles at every bracket. Ron Unz has a very famous article called The Myth of American Meritocracy, which very blindingly obvious when somebody has not read it.
Yeah, and I cite that article. I cite him three or four times, actually, in different topics. You know, for example, on the protest, what happened to the protests on the you know, the Gaza war, you know, compared to what happened, you know, in 2020 with Black Lives Matter. The protests on campus have been shut down, and you know, you've had these Jewish thugs come in UCLA and beat the crap out of people, and nothing happened. Jews suing UCLA because their classes were interfered with. This did not happen.
Can anyone hear me?
Before, so yeah, it's just a test of, you know, it's an aspect of Jewish power, and we have to deal with it, and it's very important. There's probably no issue that we in our country that isn't affected by Jewish power. Free speech is a great example. I mean, and just now, you know, Netanyahu's applauding the fact that TikTok is being taken over by Larry Ellison, who's a staunch neocon, who appointed Barry Weiss to be the head of CBS. Barry Weiss calls herself a fanatical Zionist. You know, so we're going to have a change in the mainstream media there, but TikTok is a critical thing that appeals to the young. And he was advocating people putting pressure on Elon Musk to straighten out X and, you know, make it, you know, safe for Israel and the Jews and everything else. We've got to hope that Elon Musk hangs in there. But, yeah, there's a lot of pressure right now.
You know, it's interesting. Oh. It's interesting, you know, the buying of TikTok by Ellison, because, you know, Jonathan Greenblatt said that, you know, he specifically named TikTok as being one of the biggest problems
when
it's reaching to the youth. And Ellison, of course, is the largest private donor to the IDF. And I wanted to ask you, Kevin McDonald, you write a lot about Jewish intellectual movements, and in these movements, there are key Gentile figures in them. So I was just going to, with Israel ramping up the funding for Gentile political activists to go out and do their Zionism and try to get the ear of the youth back, how pivotal would you say that Gentiles are in Jewish intellectual movements?
They're important. And they are actively recruited by Jews. Think about neoconservatives, a great example, where they have, and this is typical of Jewish movements, where they are well-funded. Think about our movement, you know, we're operating on a shoestring compared to what they're dealing with. So with neoconservatives, you've got all these think tanks, you've got lobbying groups, you've got AIPAC and the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, you've got, there are all kinds of them. And they offer positions to non-Jews who are on page. So if you want a nice career, you know, just talk up Israel. And, you know, I think that's one thing that they really liked Charlie Kirk for a long time because he had this huge audience and he was talking up Israel and defending Israel and all that. They love that. And, but, you know, so they will promote people like that. But I found that certainly with psychoanalysis, Gentile, forget his name right now, but, you know, well, there's Jung that was put forward because Freud, quote, needed a goy. And, you know, with Jews on the left, these Marxist Jews would recruit non-Jews who would not really fit into those groups and would not feel comfortable because they were really Jewish groups. And Frankfurt School, in that case, really not so much, but you did have people like Habermas and so on, like they were sort of second-generation Frankfurt School. But the rest of them were all Jews. Adorno was half-Jewish, but very strongly identified as a Jew. And, so it's repetitive, and it's something that they have to do because they're a small minority. If you're a small minority, what do? You get allies. You know,
second chapter, you cite letters that Boaz had with Warburg, and they deliberately talked about Warburg, and Boaz knew that it was it was needed to have Gentiles present the research because they knew that, you know, they could be accused from anti-Semitism, you know, presenting this radical research. And so would you say that Gentiles, Jews recruit Gentiles to try to kind of hide the fact of, you know, it being a Jewish movement and not being accused of anti-Semitism because they could go, look, there's a Gentile here, like a Margaret Mead, for an example, with the Boesians.
Absolutely. That's the whole reason for doing it. And Boaz himself set up a committee that he wanted to, you know, a prominent. You're always trying to get prominent people. I mean, the whole Jewish model of culture is top down. You get the top people and you get the media and the academic elites, Harvard and so on, and it's top down and the influence flows from top to bottom. So,
Dr. Bedell, this brings up one thing we've kind of been talking about earlier, which was that the media, so if you view the culture of critique, the 20th century is arguably like the zenith of the culture of critique, if you will. Like they have total control, being run by the most competent operators. The 21st century, especially like post, say, 2012, has been defined by a bit of a shift, maybe you could argue lower competence of them, just almost directly assuming control. They're no longer trusting Gentile front people. You're seeing a lot of like more like Jews in politics, Jews as state governors, Jews as presidential candidates, Jews as CEOs instead of just shareholders. Have you also like noticed kind of this shift into a kind of a more nakedly authoritarian model of like Jewish influence and power?
Well, I do think that the Jews are that they gravitate to authoritarianism. They want an authoritarian government that they're in charge of, and that's why they don't believe in free speech. They don't really believe in democracy. I've often said that Jews don't have any principles at all. What they have is interests, and what their interests are is to have as much power and control as they can manage. And it's not easy for them, as a relatively small minority. And with a long history, really, we do have a long history of anti-Jewish movements of various kinds, Middle Ages, late Roman Empire, Russian pogroms, and going up to the Holocaust. And now what's going on, and, you know, it's amazing how they will call any the Palestinian, complaint or uprising, anti-Semitism when, they have oppressed the Palestinians unbelievably cruelly, and who would put up with that? So they're an amazing people, and I don't, at the moment, I do think that Israel is in, I don't know, you get different points of view. You have to listen to someone like Scott Ritter. He thinks Israel's on the last legs and all that, but.
Hey, is my mic still messing up, Marcel? Am I okay now?
You sound perfectly fine now.
You're a little loud, but you're
okay.
Good.
All right, I'll turn myself down. Sorry about that. So I since we were talking about something earlier, I would like to ask Dr. McDonald about. I think he's key in talking about. It's also great to hear your voice, Dr. McDonald. How you doing?
Fine.
So we were talking about Jewish upbringing. I think Germar had brought this up. Jewish upbringing and the way they're sort of socialized. And yeah. I remember reading when we've been rereading your books, as you know, rereading the first People That Shall Dwell Alone, and then there, which is a little bit maybe less read than Culture of a Tea, but I still urge everyone to read all three. And you talked about Jewish socializing one another for high interpersonal conflict situations, for high conflict situations, sort of almost like brainwashing their children to believe that they are under threat from the Goyim at all times, which then will lead to, in conjunction with their mythos of genocide from their holy books and such, leads to them carrying out the kinds of atrocities that we see, like this idea that everything is a high stakes face off, like everything is very intense. And then additionally, you also have then their own mythology of themselves committing genocide and celebrating it. So wanted you to comment more on that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a siege mentality, and I talked about socialization in the first book, and there's a siege mentality where you think that the outside world's out to get you at all times, one of the points that I had put in there was the wealthy people, wealthy Jews, would have these sort of escape routes and secret passageways in their houses because they'd be afraid of some kind of pogrom coming down their way. So it was just a pervasive mentality. And Jews have always had a tendency to exaggerate what has happened to them. And so these events go down in history. I mean, for example, when the Crusaders went off to the Holy Land, they sometimes beat up Jews in various things or tried to get them to convert. And that became part of Jewish lore, throughout the centuries. It's really the same story over and over again. But now, of course, it does focus, as again we're rules, focus on the Holocaust as the ultimate example. But we are victims is the narrative, and I really do think that's going to change a bit. They just can't portray themselves as victims anymore when they're doing this to the Palestinians and the ethnic cleansing and the mass murder that they've engaged in. It was really a wake-up call for me to read about Jews and Bolshevism because, the first couple decades of the Soviet Union, it was just absolutely genocidal. And mass murder, 20 million murdered. Just imagine that. It was like a million a year and gulags and absolute oppression and everybody being afraid to talk and everything. That's, in a way, that is the ideal Jewish situation. And I do worry about the future if white people become a minority. I mean, there's still this vestigial atavistic hatred towards white Christians. You just don't know. All the Western countries are heading a direction of being minority white. And you just don't know what is going to happen. They still have powerful Jewish communities. So the future is iffy, shall we say.
I don't know so much as a question, but I do want to, well, I guess it is a question. you know, you mentioned Kaufness, and, you know, you and him had his back, that back and forth. I consider him a Jewish intellectual activist. I think he only does this. I think, yeah, exactly, precisely. Because I wrote an article, I wrote a little article for Substack where I think I debunked his first paper in 2018 and then his paper in 2023. Very poor scholarship. But I've noticed, you know, you have a chapter two on Bayesian anthropologists, and there's other people who deny the existence of biological race that are in that chapter, and that research was used to justify the civil rights movement and other things like that. But there's also a noticeable chunk of Jews in the race, you know, what we call the race realist camp as well. Einzink is one of them. The co-writer of The Bell Curve, I forget his name.
Richard Herrnstein.
Herrnstein. And you're seeing a general trend, almost resembles the neoconservatives during from the 60s to the 80s and eventually establishing supremacy in the Republican Party in, you know, the 90s and 2000s. You're seeing that trend kind of again, which is shifting towards the right wing. And I was wondering, do you think the reason why Jews are becoming more right wing is because of the left's opposition toward it? And how does that correspond with your theory that Jewish identity intensifies as anti-Semitism also intensifies?
Yeah, well, I do think that Jews are turning to the right more. That was apparent in the last election, even though still most Jews voted Democrat. And there's, you know, a lot of hatred towards Trump among Jews, but Trump has been proven malleable and serving Jewish interests regarding Israel, but not, you know, not the other part of the Jewish program, which is immigration, multiculturalism, DEI, all these other things that have, you know, lessened white power and that sort of thing. So, and I do think though that Jews probably feel more under threat. I mean, I get emails from the ADL, and just today they're saying, you know, there's never been more anti-Semitism in America in history, and they're, you know, they're like this crisis mode and that makes them identify more. That's happened every war that they've had, including the Gaza war. You have more synagogue attendance, more donations, more identification. I mean, in my book, I have this quote from a rabbi. I said, I didn't realize how Jewish I was. And this guy was a fixture of the Jewish community. But, you know, it's like this intense Jewishness comes out. And it was really astonishing back in the 60s, 1967 war. And I witnessed this kind of thing where suddenly the Jewish leftists on campus who were all about love and peace and anti-war in Vietnam, suddenly they, you know, wanting to rape the Palestinians and anybody else over there and the Egyptians and just absolute warmongers when it came to Israeli interests. So, you know, I saw that kind of stuff back in the 60s, but it didn't really register with me, you know. I didn't, you know, perhaps see the importance of it and how common that is. When Jews feel threatened, they identify more. But that's true of us, too. And I do think that white people feel more under threat now. When they do, they are much more open to, you know, messages of white interests. And that is a good sign. I hope it's not too late. I worry about that. But there's more evidence, I think, that whites are identifying as white and that they see themselves as part of white culture and that sort of thing. So I'm always an optimist, and I think that's the kind of thing. It's a human universal. It's more so in Jews. Jews always feel under threat and under siege, as we said. But white people feel, you know, less so. We're more individualist, and so we see a badly behaving Jew. We don't blame all Jews, you know, whereas Jews are going to sort of generally be more, you know, group-oriented and blame groups and have very strong in-group, out-group sensibility. So
I think what you said earlier about Jews not really having principles but having interests is important for people to understand, because I think a misconception, even among people who maybe are familiar with your book or familiar with what they think it says, or possibly even have maybe read some of it, because, you know, the bulk of the movements, this is corrected somewhat in the new edition with the chapter on neoconservatism, but the bulk of it is sort of left-leaning, and it's like racial deconstruction and things like that. And so people might get into their heads that these are always and going to be Jewish interests. Like, Jews are always going to have an interest in these things. But that's not necessarily the case. And if there is a rising white movement, Jews are going to want to get involved in that too, right? They're going to want to make sure that they can, if they see a white identitarian movement or racial self-awareness rising, and through anti-immigration and all this stuff, and you see Jews do get involved in these things, and they try and neuter it so it's not anti-Semitic, make it pro-Israel and such. And so it's not really surprising that there's a lot of discontent among whites in both America and in Europe with immigration. And it's a sort of suppressed racialism, right? Like, a lot of white people don't want to talk about it as racial, but everyone knows that it really is. And Jews see that, and like, that's a potential threat. So they want to get out in front of that, and they want to make sure that, let's steer that. We see this with Yoram Hazony. Like, he wants to take that energy and like steer it into, you know, into Zionism and pro-Israel feeling. And
absolutely. I think that if they do see a powerful, pro-white movement, they will try to get involved and prevent it from being Jewish. Anti-Jewish, you think about National Socialism, they did not succeed in that. And actually, Andrew Joyce had a nice article. Andrew Joyce is a brilliant guy, and he had a nice article on how in the 19th century these Jews were trying to co-opt the sort of German nationalist movement and direct it, differently, so it wouldn't be anti-Jewish. I think that is something you can certainly expect that will happen, for sure. And then one of the things that Kaufman will say, and it's true, that you can find Jews on either side of any issue. But what I have argued and shown, I think, is that what you have to pay attention to is, where's the power? I mean, there are people like Jewish Voice for Peace, there's Mondo Weiss and people like that, and they're very critical of Israel. But at the same time, they don't have the power. It's AIPAC, the Israel lobby, the American government being pulled around by its nose into these wars and so on. So, it's just not as important, anywhere near as important, and they're not as well funded or anything as these pro-Israel group. So you have to look at where the power is in all cases. And you can find, you can find Jews on the right, even back in the 1930s, when, being on the left, including communists, was really part of the mainstream Jewish community. And they were very happy. American Jews were quite happy about what happened in the Soviet Union, the Bolshevik Revolution. But, you could find Jews who dissented from that, but they didn't have the power within the community, and so that's what you always have to do.
Well, one of the things that I've seen happen a lot with many of the conservative Republican Party oriented like defenders of Israel, like very recently, Alex Jones did a show with Ezra Levant of Rebel Media, and they were very much leaning on Judaism as a religion, Judaism as a group of individuals. Jews are all different people. You can't judge all Jews based on what some do. But nonetheless, they kept coming up against this problem of what they were calling, and even Ezra Levant had to use this word, like the official Jews or like the big Jews. Now, he pre he himself is a very wealthy Jew who owns a media network, but he does this pretense like he's like this plucky upstart because he wants to keep the Alex Jones audience and keep them from being anti-Semitic or knowing that that members of his audience are dabbling in that. And so he's very focused on this individualist narrative, but he kept, and even Alex Jones also had to sort of do this too. They had to acknowledge the existence of big organized Jewry that is very clearly at odds with the interests of his own viewers, and they have to like cope with this. And it's just very interesting scenes. And even Charlie Kirk did this. There's a Charlie Kirk, a very famous clip of him talking about Jews funded all this left-wing stuff and mass immigration and the ADL has gone after conservatives. And like he was, of course, celebrating when he saw Jews saying, oh, now we're voting Republican. And it was very specifically related to October 7th. So I do think this shift is happening. I mean, it's definitely happening. It would be a mistake for Jews, from their own perspective, to let one flank of the political spectrum become anti-Semitic or become not controlled by them. I think that it all really just depends on what they think. I mean, there's not that many of them. They have a huge, big problem, this huge empire they have to manage. And they got to make some trade-offs. And I think they're sort of willing to, right now, Israel is the priority. Maybe we can appeal to, you know, white people who have racial ideas on the basis like, hey, we're a white country and we're fighting these Islamic savages and things like that. And so, yeah, it's definitely out there. And it does fit very well with your theoretical description of how they operate, which is, yeah, not just being leftists. Like if that's how you think, if you read Kevin's books and that's what you came away with, you should read them again.
Well, one of the terms I use is flexible strategizer. They're very flexible and they will change their positions depending on the context. As I say, no principles, they got interest and they're going to pursue their interest. Interest differently, you know, it's like an argument in the Israeli Knesset, you know, that they're going to have different opinions. But at the same time, you have to look, where is the influence coming from? Where, you know, think about Larry Ellison now. I mean, huge amount of wealth he's got. You know, now he's going to control TikTok algorithm and Paramount and CBS and throwing it into media, and this is a long Jewish tradition of that, but it's going to shift things in the direction of neoconservatism and pro-Israel activism and that sort of thing. And yeah, it's pretty clearly part of his.
Dr. Rudolph, you were fixing to say something. Do you have anything to?
Yes, I have a question for Dr. McDonald. Concerning the new editions of your book, because I have looked at Amazon, the old editions have been censored numerous years ago, and on occasion, I think one of them is still available, but not the other two, and you can maybe find the German translation of it. The new editions don't show on Amazon. Have they been into international
distribution? I can feel this one. I have a little more visible on the publisher side. So Amazon, the publisher has, so Dr. Nell's works are not allowed on Amazon. The publisher that I'm intimately familiar with, we have methods of occasionally for now and then slipping them on, but they are currently under censorship on Amazon. Occasionally we have methods and means that we can get them on for a couple days. Barnes & Noble, however, the American book distributor, will ship internationally comparably, relatively affordably. We are there. So if you're international, yeah, and you can't, because buy from Analog Hill directly, the shipping costs are extortionate for a million reasons to do with tariffs and international trade. I recommend going to the American book publisher Barnes & Nobles and buying directly if you're international right now, or wait until we sneak it back on Amazon for a week or two.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not for me. It's so much a question as where can I get it, because I could get it. I know how to get my books if I want them. Now, fact is that 85% of new books are being sold through Amazon nowadays, and a search algorithm is when people look for something and then stumble over something else. If you're just excluded from Amazon, the potential readership that does not know anything about you yet you're missing out on is just tremendous. And I was just interested.
Yes, we did get it up on there for, I think, 3 weeks initially.
This is actually a perfect segue for a quick ad read. So for those who want to see more content from Mike, Borzoi, Lewis, and then we thought Sven was coming on later, but seemingly not, go to therightstuff.biz. I can't post a link to the website. It is, in fact, the most censored website on the internet, but it's exactly what I said, therightstuff.biz.
Great stuff.
Dr. Rudolph, I have a question
for you. I didn't finish my ad read.
Dr. McDonald. Oh, I thought that was all you had.
You forgot I was going to plug. I have content to plug. Our speakers have content to plug. Second of all, for those who want to read Dr. McDonald's book, you should go to – so the most recent edition of Culture of Critique is on antelopehillpublishing.com. Antelope Hill also has a Twitter page, so you can go to that. Also, for his first two books, they are available on the UNS Review. Actually, all three are available on the UNS Review. So you can read Separation and Its Discontents and People That Shall Dwell Alone there.
If I may, myself, really quick, Borzoi and I are doing a read-through of the series. We are on the new edition of The Culture of Critique. Just today, we talked about Boaz and the first half of the chapter on Boaz and the Boasian School of Anthropology. We are going to be finishing up the rest of the book, and hopefully Kevin will be joining us again for another interview when we finish it, or maybe whenever is convenient for him. So if you want to read the books and feel like you're reading along with your internet friends, you can listen
You're still way too loud.
Oh, sorry.
It's probably best to buy them from Antelope Hill because
yes,
you know, they would make more money on that.
But then, yes, and sorry. Listen along to Mike on the rightstuff.biz on his show, Painovich and Voskovich, as well.
Sorry if I'm too loud. I will back off the mic. Sorry.
Yeah. If you want to read Garamar's books, they are all on armreg.co.uk. Armreg also has a Twitter page, which I believe is Armreg, A-R-M-R-E-G, underscore official. I do believe Armreg is, by some strange metric, Garamar backwards.
Yes, almost. The last two letters were flipped. We needed to come up. Well, my friend who set that up actually didn't tell me he would do that. But it is an abbreviation for a long string of things, academic research, media review, and education group, but that's kind of made up in order to kind of fit into my name backward. Yeah,
I never noticed that before, and now I feel stupid. That is hilarious.
And Jose, you can see Jose's content on the Barnes Review. So Jose's been a little bit quiet, but he runs the Barnes Reviews podcast. It's named after Harry Elmer Barnes, who's another very famous historical, well, famous, right? You know, a very well-published historical revisionist. So you can see his content there. Also at the Occidental Observer, which is published by Kevin McDonald as well. You know, it's all one thing. It's all connected. How's that for your media market? Finally, to promote myself, so I run the Property and Freedom Book Club. If you want to be able to access that, just click on the co-host of the space who is named Property and Freedom Book Club, and you'll see a link to the server, and thus you can do that.
Don't forget Josh Neal.
Oh, Josh Neal. Okay, so Josh Neal has he has a Substack. I forgot the URL for it. But you can buy his books, which is the real important thing. Two of his books are for sale on Imperium Press. Just type it in on the Twitter search. And his last book, Intolerant Interpretations, is published by Antelope Hill as well.
Yeah, all right. I have a show I do with Labubu here on Rumble. It's called Eviction Notice. The link to it is in the Jumbotron. It's pinned where we talk about all the we give you correct political opinions for you to regurgitate to your friends. Dr. Rudolph, I had a question for you real quick. Dr. McDonald talks about how there's a new, not really a new culture in the Jewish community, but there's a culture of the Holocaust, the culture of where you're a perpetual victim. And you just did a brilliant documentary on the Nuremberg trials. And I was wondering if you could kind of express how important was the Nuremberg trials for building up this mythos around the Holocaust?
Well, that's a short question with a very long answer if I put my mind to it. But I want to try to be concise here. The founding myths of the Holocaust come primarily from Soviet Stalinist Polish sources. They were introduced during the Nuremberg trial as a sacred truth, and as such, the Nuremberg trial, in particular the International Military Tribunal, the other 12 trials, they didn't get much attention, had a very crucial importance to jumpstart this entire propaganda. If you look into the actual evidence that couldn't be contested, most of the evidence on gas chambers on mass murder that were uncontestably chiseled in stone during the proceedings because of government commissions that had Soviet, mostly Soviet and Polish government commissions that the Soviet then had adopted, and they could not be challenged. So yeah, it was the most important event in the long history of the formation of that myth. Now, if you look into what the Holocaust story pushed today by the orthodoxy looks like and what was pushed at Nuremberg, there are massive discrepancies. So it was not the event that defined the Holocaust as it is pushed today, but it is most certainly a very important, a crucial step in ramming it down the official throat, in particular when it comes to Germany, to the German national subconscious. It was a pivotal event. Yeah, if you want to watch that documentary, by the way, holocausthandbooks.com has a section, a video, where you can get all the documentaries that I've done. There's up to 9 now, but there are more on some other people have done documentaries on the topic too. And the most recent one is there, The Holocaust Proven at Nuremberg is the title. And it refers actually to a docudrama that comes out on November 7th, if I'm not mistaken. Mainstream docudrama and comes into the cinemas where they dramatize the Nuremberg trial scene from the perspective of Hermann Göring and his prosecutors. So that's my reaction to that, having put out this documentary. We have also a book with the same title, which you can get both on holocausthandbooks.com as a free download and on armreg.co.uk as a book, which, by the way, it is a UK domain, but the books are shipped from the US too. We have an outlet here, so that is an international fulfillment contractor we have there. It's pretty convenient. Did that answer the question?
I believe so.
Yes, very much.
If you're in the audience, curious as to watch Gamar's new documentary, right? That's the ultimate answer. If you're,
I just want to emphasize why it is important not to leave this issue for last. Like, the reason you should engage in World War II revision and Holocaust revision is because it will make you a better person. Because as it currently exists, the Holocaust is not a lesson to plagiarize someone else who may be in the room with us. The Holocaust is not a lesson on the dangers of war. It is a lesson on the danger of peace. It is moral blackmail against people who don't want to bomb Saddam Hussein, who don't want to bomb Bashar al-Assad, who don't want to bomb Iran. Furthermore, as you get into far-right politics, you should not let yourself believe that, like, the Holocaust is a price that you have to pay to be free, right? This is sort of the endemic moral blackmail. Why can't you have your own country? Because of the Holocaust. If you don't challenge that narrative on the facts, you may end up allowing yourself to become a bad person for literally no reason. For no reason, you may start to convince yourself and get mad. It's like, no, in my mind, Hitler was an insane mass murderer who gassed Jews, and I think that's good. I love Durlewanger, right? We see these people. You don't have to be that guy. You can be a good person. You can connect to the real world, have the right political opinions, defend your sovereignty, defend your right to exist, and you don't need to have it in your head. And it's like, you know, this guilty conscience, almost this sort of loud blustering, like, and I am a genocidal freak. I'm a genocidal maniac. It is on the table. You know, you don't got to be the kind of person that says things like that.
Yeah, I would say it is important to understand, even though people want to avoid that topic, and I myself have avoided it the first 30 years or 27 years of my life. I was very interested in history and German history, being a German myself, tried to be a patriot. And as a German patriot, you're being constantly clobbered with the Holocaust, because that's the delegitimization of German patriotism, if you wish. But that is being done with all in extension with all right-wing identitarian movement that are white. So if you're an Amazon Indian or a Tibetan indigenous person, you won't be attacked for being supportive of Adolf Hitler's idea if you try to have your own identity. But if you're a European, it will come up. It will be used against you as a weapon. And it is a good idea to know what we're talking about to be able to defend yourself, or even better, to go on the counterattack. As they say, attack is the best defense. If somebody comes up with that, if okay, you want to discuss it, we want to discuss the Holocaust, if you have good arguments to checkmate the opposition by showing them that, first of all, they have no clue what they are talking about, and then really making fun of them by showing how corrupt the story is, how admittedly corrupt, even by the mainstream. If you know the history, how often they have revised and admitted over the time that they have lied, invented, and exaggerated. And if you can confront them with their own admissions or their own ideological leaders' admission of frequent revision because, yes, we lied. And they admit, no, it was not an error. We lied because it served our anti-fascist purpose. And the quote's out there. And if you can do that, that is a counterattack that checkmates the opposition and blows your way free. I always compare the Holocaust with the cork in the bottle. We have a bottle full of problems in the world, and there is this cork sitting in the neck, and it doesn't go out. There is no way around it. Even if you think you can avoid the topic, your opposition will come and badger you with it. So yes, it is good to know what you're up against.
Yeah, the story was created to be the most evil thing that could possibly be, right? Everything about it is, it's there so that any person of like normal ethical development will say, if that is what happens when Europeans get too big for their britches, then we need to be careful of getting too big for their britches. And to have it in your head, to have this pee under the mattress, where you're thinking to yourself, like, well, maybe Hitler was a good person, but then also he did the Holocaust. You know, I hate to break it to you guys. Somebody who perpetrates the Holocaust as described cannot be a good person. You should not try to contort yourself. You don't have to contort yourself into thinking that a good person perpetrated the Holocaust. You don't need to ask yourself. Go ahead.
There's another aspect to this. Hopefully I'm not blasting everyone's ears off. I'll try and back off a little bit. There's another aspect to this of you saying, if you believe in it and you believe that it is the price that you have to pay, that you can become a bad person. And it's not just that you might become the cartoon Nazi, the idea of the Nazi that they have erected for you, that you'll just become that guy. The other thing is that you'll become a neocon, that you will say, well, the Holocaust is the price we have to pay. We have to live with Jewish power. And you'll become a Zionist. You'll say, to be a conservative because of the Holocaust, we can't ever refute this, so we need to recruit Jews. We need to work with Jews. We need to, if we were going to get the only way we get a moral excuse to control the border, to control immigration, like with Zionists, you win, right? As our friend Martin says, like you get to do deportations because Jews are there. So you have the Zionist Jews on your side. So it's not just the risk that you'll become like the cartoonish Nazi Hitler lover. You know, I am an admirer of Hitler, but I am an admirer of the real Hitler. So that's very different than the one that is portrayed to you. So I don't consider myself like the cartoon style, obviously not. But the other danger is that you'll just become like a neoconservative Zionist because you don't want to confront it. So you just have to concede. Well, Jews have this right. They have this right to have this level of power and influence. We can't fight it. And I don't, you know, so that's the other danger, just to reiterate or just to offer another point of view on what you were saying.
Yeah, cartoonish Nazism in defense of Jews, right? Like you embrace
the more often than you, more common than you'd think, right?
A little loud.
Sorry,
but yeah,
well,
you know,
if I may chip in there once more, you don't have to be an admirer of it.
Sorry, I clicked the wrong thing. I didn't mean to do that. Sorry, just unmute yourself, Doctor. Rudolph,
sorry.
I didn't mean to do that.
I did that again, didn't I?
No, I did that. That was on me.
Oh, sorry. Okay. You don't have to be you don't have to admire Hitler or have one way or another position. For me, it's Hitler in the National Socialist area is to be historicized and looked at objectively, and the only way to do it is by allowing free speech, open debate, and tolerance, and the stop to the censorship. Only then can we find the truth to any problem, historic or not. So whatever your position is toward that part of German history, that is, for me, secondary. But the Holocaust, one way or another, will always come up, and there's no way around it to deal with it. To delude yourself, you can avoid it. It's just the minefield that they put around their own positions, and you have to cross it, and you have to be able to handle it. By the way, we have actually a summit that's coming on, the holocaustsummit.com, on the 27th of January, where we will discuss problems surrounding the Holocaust as a taboo and a historical topic, the Holocaust as a political weapon, as we see it now in Gaza, the Holocaust as a muzzle to stifle debate, to have basically censorship, anything that the lobby doesn't like. So if you're interested in a discussion centered around that topic, go to holocaustsummit.com and look around, and maybe some of you may even want to submit a paper there. And we have the holocaustacademy.org, where we try to reach out to people to teach exactly, to be prepared for what's coming. If you get involved, if you are an influencer, if you are a journalist, we spoke about that, or whatever your path is into the public arena, taking a stance, right-wing, identitarian, whatever it may be, anything that the lobby, the Jewish lobby, the Zionist lobby dislikes, you will be attacked, and that is their wonder weapon, their miracle weapon that they will use. To be fit and knowledgeable in that field, to be able to counter it so that they will think twice to attack you with it, is very important. We offer free lessons on holocaustacademy.org. I'm also just right now preparing to get my feet wet to have actually the first semester with coursework and lectures. So Dr. McDonald is out of the academic realm. They never let me in there, even though I wanted to. Lecturing was actually one of the favorite activities I did as a PhD student. And now I have created my own academy, holocaustacademy.org, completely online. And we're trying to make it fly, to teach the world the ropes of Holocaust skepticism, to make them fit for debate and for intellectual battle.
I can't wait for it, and I'm a huge supporter. But I'm going to hop off, guys. Thanks, Marcel. Thanks, Dumernet. Thanks, Germar. Thanks, everybody. I'll see you guys later. Bye.
See you, Mike.
The boosted gain. Don't hold on a second. I think I know what kind of microphone Mike has. There's a gain switch on the back. You
could just I have turned the gain down. Like it's not used to this. It's not used to interfacing through the browser. I'm all the way back off the mic. Am I still like really loud? Like I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's causing me physical pain.
Mike. We'll work it out on some other occasion.
You remember getting.
I remember getting Mike.
Was getting dominated during the Cam Higbee, so he just decided he was just going to come and rape all of our ears.
Do we want to take up other people, non-panelists, or are we fine keeping this?
I think we're okay on that front.
Okay.
I think we
got a tight 2 hours, I think.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah. I think this was really good. Dr. Rudolph, thank you for coming. Josh Neal, thank you for coming. Borzoi, thank you for coming. Labubu. Yeah, whatever. Marcel, of course, thank you for being
very good.
Marcel, so, of course, thank you. Oh, sorry.
I didn't have much to say. Yeah, I appreciated this too. It's a learning curve for me. I'm so dug in. I'm currently editing the French translation of the encyclopedia, and I'm working with an Egyptian getting an Arabic translation out, which will hopefully have some impact. So translating an entire encyclopedia into several languages and working with that, I have a Portuguese, a Greek, and a Polish on my desk too. You can imagine the kind of work I'm in. And I do not really pay much attention because I don't have the time to much else. So the Gaza conflict is always in the back of my mind, but in the periphery of my perception. And so I have learned quite a little bit today listening to you guys, what your perception is and what your take on things is and what the situation is. And I appreciate that very much.
I'm happy to have you on, of course, Dr. Rudolph. Could you follow me back, Dr. Rudolph? I think I gotta get K-Mac to follow me back too. Like, this parasocial relationship needs to be bilateral.
Of course I can do that. Social media is still a book with seven seals to me sometimes. I figure it out how to do that.
Yeah. Jose, do you have anything? You've been quiet all night. I'm sure you've got some thoughts for us, Jose.
No, I really enjoyed this conversation, and I view October 7th as a watershed moment of, especially the response afterwards of Jewish power revealing itself, and I think it's actually a good thing because it makes the friend-enemy distinction actually real, and it also has exposed a ton of people that I've long suspected of being subversives, and I like this whole community we're building that's actually quite eclectic and transpartisan in nature, and it's talking about serious stuff that goes beyond the left-right paradigm, something that I think is just way out of date, and it's time for like a new model altogether.
Mr. Josh Neal, do you have anything to add? You've been a little bit quiet on this time. Do you have anything to say?
Marcel asked me earlier, and I avoided answering the question, but he asked about, you know, the proliferation of conspiracies surrounding Israel and Jewish influence and things of that nature. I've been reading a book by Keith Stanovich, who's an influential Canadian cognitive psychologist. He actually put forth some of the ideas that Daniel Kahneman would later popularize, namely the ideas of system one and system two cognition, which sort of, without getting into the weeds, it's a mischaracterization of Stanovich's work. But if we're trying to understand why there's all this muddled conspiratorial thinking with regards to Jews, which is to say the wrong kind of conspiratorial thinking, because it's not a problem that people are conspiratorially minded about Jews, the relationship between Israel and America, things of that nature. It's that it's not, you know, from a first principles perspective, it's not identity based. What Stanovich argued is that cognition, he argues for what he calls a tripartite model of cognition, which is that you have type one thinking, which is low in effort. It's Dr. Rudolph talked about the Pavlovian tendencies within Jewish psychology. It's based on sort of a Pavlovian learned response. When we think of pattern recognition, that's usually what is active in the mind. It's this type one immediate, fast reacting, low effort, intuitive pattern recognizing consciousness or cognition. And I think that's what, particularly for Gentiles, that's where most of us are most of the time. And that's where you get these sort of wild intuitive leaps about why things happen, who is responsible. And that's why you never get, you know, to me, the important part of any conspiracy theory is really the middle part, the investigation. It's not just enough that you can identify a conspiracy and that you can identify the conspirators, but you actually have to have a coherent, logical investigation in between, right? And if we think of, not to go off topic, the Charlie Kirk shooting, I don't know where you guys land on this, so maybe I'm putting myself in some hot water here. But right out the gate, for not really very good reasons, a large portion of the radical right automatically jumped to Israel. with very kind of fallacious reasons, or at least half-assed, incoherent reasons. Right. So the other part of Stanovich's model is this type two thinking, which is more about what's called cognitive decoupling. I'm trying not to get too into the weeds in this, but cognitive decoupling is basically removing your mental representations from actual external stimuli. And I tend to think of, to go back to the conversation earlier about sort of the formation of Jewish identities and Jewish communities, I think the tendency of a lot of Jewish intellectuals, rabbis, is this type two, very mentally laborious, engaged in hypothetical reasoning, to the exclusion of what Keith Stanovich would say is the third part of the model, which is the reflective mind, and that's the part that looks inward at the cognitive processes, looks inward at things like prejudices, biases, personal experiences, that maybe reality tests the things in between your ears against what's happening outside of your head. And I think when we look at Jewish psychology, what we see is not a lot of reflectivity and far too much of this type two technical, effortful, working memory, heavily working memory loaded cognition. And this is where you get that sort of, when people talk about like this Talmudic style of thinking, this lawyerly style of thinking and debating, it's very much this type two mode of cognition. So for most people, and when I say most people, I mean Gentiles, they're engaged in this type one immediate gut instinct, a Pavlovian primed thinking that is, you know, for lack of a better word, it's, you know, quote, irrational. Jews are engaged in this heavily working memory loaded type two type of cognition, where, and this is where they can build these elaborate mental models and ideologies, philosophies, and things like that, which, to Dr. McDonald's point earlier, are always geared towards interests versus principles. And the lack of reflectivity, which is the third part of Stanovich's model, means that they're never interrogating these models. They're never interrogating the rational basis for these hypothetical scenarios that they're constantly engaged in. Will the Gentile across the street jump out from behind a bush and club me in the back of the head with a rock? Like, they're not interrogating that. Importantly for that type one cognition, this is also in my book, AnnalePillPublishing.com, Intolerant Interpretations. A very famous German psychologist, Gerd Gigerenzer, took all of these sorts of ideas, and the perspective he put on it that is different, that I agree with, he tends to give a lot of credence to this type one, you know, fast, effortless thinking. But he says that this occurs always in an ecological context. Whereas people like Daniel Kahneman, who was IDF psychologist, friends with Cass Sunstein, he advocates this paternalistic, technocratic censorship regime, nudge units, piecemeal social engineering, to borrow a phrase from Karl Popper. Whereas Daniel Kahneman is treating all of these cognitive processes as only ever happening within the individual mind, and that's the basis by which we evaluate cognition, Gigerenzer says that actually cognition is an ecological phenomenon, meaning it's happening in relationship to an external environment. And if you think about our external environment, it's run by Jews. You know, the information ecology is dominated by these Jewish guardrails that gatekeep information, so you don't get access to critical information, but also it provides the models and the frames of reference for which you are able to do your thinking. So Gentiles engaging in this type one intuitive, low effort, low working memory style cognition are making these cognitive conspiratorial leaps based on this primarily Jewish ecology, this primarily Jewish information ecology. And that's where I think certainly in the last two decades, but going back further than that, I say the last two decades because that's just the focus of my writing, post-internet age. I think Lewis said earlier, you know, post-2012, you know, that's a good enough frame of reference for a lot of this. If you're trying to engage in this sort of like Sherlock Holmes style investigative thing, you're hampered by the fact that the informational resources you have are entirely predetermined, and they're predetermined by these influential Jewish intellectuals, Jewish politicians, Jewish activists, academics, artists. And if they're not expressly, explicitly Jewish, then to make reference to Dr. McDonald's work, they are hand-selected Gentile mouthpieces and collaborators who are merely vehicles and vessels for approved Jewish speech, approved Jewish thought. So if we're trying to understand psychologically what is the basis for this rampant erroneous conspiratorialism about Israel or Israel in America, the Israel lobby, or about Jews in America, or about the historical relationship between Gentiles and Jews, I think that's where we need to look.
Thank you, Josh. Seth, I think we're good to – let me just do one last ad read, and then we can close out. Do you feel good about that?
Oh, can I do a closing thing?
Sure, of course.
Then quickly? Because I haven't really – yeah, I was busy tonight. I'm so grateful that we had very academic, very intelligent people on this space tonight, because it just proves our point, and something I personally stress is that we do have the best people. We do have the best people. We have the most moral people. We have the most intelligent people who are speaking to matters that things that matter politically, but also things that matter to matters of the heart. Because when people see what's happening in Palestine, the reason why that liberals are able to take that issue is because conservatives leave that to be taken by them. Like, if you're a moral person and you look at what's happening there, you should have something to say about it. You should see what's going on. When you understand what Jewish power and what the Jewish issue is, you should have something to say about it. And the problem with the right wing is they are afraid to say something about it. Because the moment, the closer they get to learning about it, the more freaked out they get about it, and the more they want to shut it down, the more they want to police other people that want to talk about it, that want to speak about it. And they especially want to shut down people who have something moral to say about it, people who are moral fagging, people who have something that they, people who are speaking from the heart, that see, like, this is fucked up, this is wrong, this does not help me, this does not help my people, this doesn't even help other people, because, like, when you're not warped by this, like, I have to play a character online, you realize, like, hey, like, I want to be a part of this actual world and, just be a normal person in this world, and Jewish power makes that impossible. And that's why I have if people wonder, like, why am I so mean? Why am I so mean and nasty to all these people? Well, it's because, like, I see how you people act, and that's how you – I treat you the way you deserve. I treat you the way you treat other people. Like, frankly, like, you look at the way these people talk to other people. Like, I treat you the way you talk to other people. I treat you exactly the way that you deserve. And so, like, if this space offends you, especially hearing these wonderful, wonderful, academic, intelligent, soft-spoken people that are speaking from the heart, if that offends you on some deep level, then I'm glad it does, and I fucking hate you, and I want to make sure that your life is ruined. So there you go.
I also, just to follow through on that, you know, I mentioned this in the very, very beginning that, you know, these cults, these sort of kosher right-wing cults, they prey on lonely people. If, you know, we got hundreds of listeners, right? Maybe you join this space because You know, there were people flipping out and saying this is going to be cringe, a bunch of has-beens, who's literally nobodies and so on. If you were sent here, you know, by a bunch of fucking retards, right? A bunch of dumb mishlings and idiots. You are, I don't want to insult you, you are in a cult. And in particular, you are, if you're young, you realize the fact that, you know, blacks are not as smart as whites. You've realized that you're going to be a minority in this country and they're counting down, right? You've seen, you've gotten through the most obvious blue pills. And now you see there's like this truth that's been hidden from you. And you don't want to be alone. You don't want to feel weak. It can't be like this. You can't be doomed. There has to be some hope. There has to be some person you can vote for. It has to be Donald Trump. And you're also worried, you know, that if you don't go along with what, you know, what Martin or whoever, right? If you don't do what they're doing, then there's just no movement to join. There's nothing left. And you're just by yourself with your normie friends. And, you know, you can't say the N-word around them. And, you know, they don't understand stuff about race IQ. They don't know what you know. And it's like a nightmare talking to them, right? You're trying to talk to normies and it's like talking to a wall. And you think to yourself, I don't want to be alone. I have to be with a movement that feels strong. These people, they like J.D. Vance. They know the memes. And if the price of admission into the cool kids club is that I need to sign off on Jews bombing kids, well, then damn it, that's a price worth paying, so I'm not alone. And I want to let you know that you do not have to be alone. It is not like that. You, like I said, you don't have to live in that way with that fear that if you don't go along with these Jewish intellectual movements, which is what they are, right, that, you know, you're basically, you'll be exiled as a brownoid. You don't need to be afraid of that. You can be a straightforwardly good and moral person and not want to go extinct. There are people who are convincing you that the price of you not going extinct is to be a bad person, and you don't need to live like that. And if you don't want to hear it from me, I understand. You have to hear it from me because I'm smart, but you can hear it from Borzoi, you can hear it from Lewis, you can hear it from Dumanat, you can hear it from anybody. You can be a good person and stay alive. It's totally possible. I'm going to do our final ad read, and then I think we're going to play us out. So, first of all, to get more from Mike, Borzoi, Lewis, you should go to therightstuff.biz. It's like we can't link to it. It's a censored website. You got to type it into your taskbar, therightstuff.biz. There you go. Next, if you want to read Kevin McDonald's book, as well as Josh Neal's, you go to antelopehillpublishing.com or Antelope Hill on Twitter. You can also read some of Kevin McDonald's other books on the UNS Review. I put those both in the Jumbotron. For more of Guillermo Rudolph's work, again, you can just go to his Twitter page. He has another page called ArmRag Official, or go to his website, armreg.co.uk. For more of Jose's work, you can, again, click on his profile, obviously. But you can also go to barnesreview.org since he runs their podcast. That's BARNESREVIEW, barnesreview.org. For Dumanat's podcast with Lewis, click on his profile. Well, it's not his pinned tweet anymore. His pinned tweet is this space. But normally, the latest episode of his show, Eviction Notice, is pinned on the top of his account. And if you want my content, of course, you can click on my profile. My pinned tweet is always my latest Substack article. Also, you see Property and Freedom Book Club. I have a book club. That's another point. The point of this book club and the point of my article series is I want to equip you. For you, young white person, who's realized that blacks have low IQs, and you're like, who do I associate with that is aware of this fact and doesn't try to gaslight me into thinking that it's not true? You know, the people that you associate with, it feels as though they're much smarter than you. They're not much smarter than you. They are more well-read than you. And even then, probably not by much. There are a variety of topics about which you can become an expert by reading one, two, or three books. Unless it's World War II, then you kind of got to read four books because most books are bad. But you can just read one, two, or three books, and there's a bunch of them. And you can realize just how easy it is to become well-equipped, to be in a space like this, to talk among people like us, and to be, you know, respected and articulate. And it's not insurmountable. You don't need to feel ignorant or alone or weak or afraid. And I'm not saying this to insult you, like, yeah, you're ignorant and you're insecure and you're weak and you're afraid. But these people, these false prophets really, are preying on that fear which if you're listening to it, you know what I'm talking about. You have that feeling like, if I don't go along with this, I'll be out of the GC. I'll be nobody. I'll have nobody to talk about Race IQ with. I'll have nobody to show clips of Sam Hyde. I'll have nobody to be red-pilled with. And I know that fear. I mean, you think you're afraid to have nobody talk about Race IQ with? You think you are worried about, man, like, who am I going to talk about red-pill shit with? Okay. So there is a way forward. You can be a good person, and you can be around good people that don't require you to believe absurdities, that don't come up with copes about how Trump is surely going to do it this time. Thank you.
We're very friendly, so make sure you join. We tend to hang out IRL from time to time. And yeah, no, we're just a community on Discord, so make sure that you hit the link in my bio and get vetted.
One correction I may put in, I said at some point that my website with the new academy is holocaustacademy.org, which is wrong. It's actually .com, but I just managed to get the .org domain. So if you go there, it should have a redirect to .com. Anyway, I give there, they're going to be free lessons, but they are also going to be paid lessons.